Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out and a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
Alright, alright, alright. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on this Wednesday morning. Wildcard Wednesday. You big Wildcard Wednesday. It's any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. Get your request in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. Hope everybody's doing well. We are here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows the show with the opening bell at 5. And Steve Cochran at 6 has your morning drive on this Wednesday morning. And we got a great show for you coming up in just a few minutes. The great Rich Coase, a.k.a. Sven Gulli, is going to join us. Sven is going to be part of the Flashback Horror Convention, Flashback Weekend Horror Convention, of which I've been a part of since 2002. I'm one of the hosts. I do Q&As. I introduce a bunch of stuff, and I just have fun there for the whole weekend. It starts on Friday, goes through Sunday at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Rosemont, Crown Plaza O'Hare in Rosemont. And it's basically when all the horror geeks take over the hotel for a full weekend, and a bunch of stars and directors and actors and actresses and horror fanatics all fill up the ballrooms and the hotel with costumes and fun. And Sven is going to be there, as he is every year, but it's a special celebration this year because Rich Coase is celebrating 40 years of playing Sven Gulli. Yeah, that's right. It's the 40th anniversary of Sven Gulli, and we're going to celebrate it on Friday at the Crown Plaza at the Flashback Convention. And I will be hosting a retrospective, 40 years of Sven Gulli. It'll be me and Rich on stage. We'll have clips and have some fun. It'll be 7 o'clock Friday night at the Crown Plaza Hotel in the big ballroom. And I hope you guys can all make it. You can get there a little bit early at 6:30. You can do a photo op with Sven as well. And then he always appears on the Saturday of Flashback Weekend, where he does a bunch of autographs, photo opportunities, and he hosts the costume contest, which is always unbelievably hilarious and memorable. So 2 days of Sven Gulli at the convention. Normally he's just there on Saturday, but he's also going to be there on Friday. And I am honored to be moderating the celebration of the 40th anniversary of Sven Gulli Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Crown Plaza Hotel, part of Flashback Weekend. Go to flashbackweekend.com. We're going to be talking about Flashback a lot this morning and tomorrow as we lead into Friday. It all begins Friday. And I'm there the entire weekend. I'm taking Friday morning off, and I'm taking Monday morning off because I'm going to need to recuperate because I very rarely get any rest or sleep. I'm running around like a lunatic at that thing. And come up and say hi. Flashbackweekend.com, full schedule, lots of stars. I'll give you some details coming up in a little bit. But Sven is going to join us, the great Rich Coase, in just a few minutes. And we're going to, you know, Rich obviously hosts a great horror film, a local horror film show. And so we're going to talk about the essential golden age of horror. We're going to talk about some of the scariest CGI monsters, jumping into that. We are also going to jump into Know Your Onion after the 4:30 news. Tom will be your host. He will read you some news headlines, and you have to decide whether it's real or it's from The Onion, which is the fake, funny, satirical newspaper. The real news nowadays is just so insane and weird that you can barely tell it the difference between that and an Onion headline. But if you can do that, if you can be one of our two contestants, we're going to have two separate contestants playing two rounds, you'll win some prizes. So that's Know Your Onion. That's coming up after the 4:30 news. And then we just got some weird pop culture lawsuits Some of these are just extremely strange. So that's all coming up on the show. Again, Wild Card Wednesday. Get your requests in now. Any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200. So, all right. Let me say hello to my producer, the great Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Nick.
How are you, man?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. You excited about Flashback?
Yeah. I mean, it's my first one. And, of course, the first one I get to go to has Sam Raimi, yeah. Bruce Campbell, Ted Raimi.
Yeah.
Everybody. Tony
Todd. Robert Englund. Yeah. Lots of the ladies from the Nightmare movies.
I'm going to be very nervous meeting Heather Langenkamp.
She's awesome. She's really sweet.
I know. I've heard so many good things. I know she's so used to this sort of thing, but yeah. I'm still going to be a little bit of a shaky mess getting to talk to her.
She's really sweet. She's been to the convention. I think this is probably her fifth or sixth time.
Wow. So she's a pro.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of the ladies that are coming back from the Nightmare, those ladies have all been at the convention before. And also Serena Vincent, who was in Cabin Fever, she's been at the convention a few times, too. She's lovely, and she's very cool. I'm very excited to reunite with Lisa Zane.
Yeah.
Who is a terrific actress who was in Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. And she's also from Chicago. Her brother is Billy Zane, actor Billy Zane. You should listen to your friend Billy Zane, which is the only funny line in Zoolander. She's a terrific actress, and I hung out with her like 26 years ago. We hung out, and she came to town to do like the Chicago Film Critic Awards. And we got to be buddies and friends, and I haven't seen her since then. So it's going to be fun to reunite with her. And she's never been to our Flashback convention, but it's going to be great. And of course, the whole thing with Rich is going to be. I mean, I'm just so excited.
I know. Generations of people growing up watching him.
Yeah.
You know.
And when you're there, particularly on Saturday when he does his autograph session, Sven always has like the longest line. Every single year, his line is like a mile long, and people waiting to get pictures with him and autographs and stuff like that. He's just a legend, and we're very, very excited to welcome him to the show in just a couple of minutes. So we'll talk to him. It's going to be a fun weekend. In the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
How are you, man?
Doing very well.
Yeah. All right. So the Cubs can't score runs.
Unfortunately, I had a plan to switch between the debate and the game, but I ended up just watching the debate, so I missed it all.
Yeah. Well, you didn't miss much.
No.
No. Yu Darvish pitched well again, but the Cubs scored no there was no mm-hmm. offense for him.
Yeah.
He should have a lot more than three wins. That's all I'm saying. He's pitching really well, but nobody's hitting for him.
No.
You can't win ball games if you don't get hits and runs.
That's... I'm a little upset with the whole organization because of what they did to me, being the partner of a Brewers fan.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, that was a rough time. Now,
at least we won the last one.
At least you don't live with a St. Louis fan. That would be a lot worse.
It would be worse. Yeah,
it would be much worse. But now they're out of first place. Game out. St. Louis is in first.
That's
and,
right.
Man,
line up again tomorrow.
Yep. Yep. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. So. Well, hopefully, right. I'll catch some of that one.
Yeah. All right. And well, there's another debate tonight. So. Because, you know, there's 63 people running for the Democratic
Party. Yeah, I know. And I've seen most of the candidates that are going to be in the debate tonight. I've seen most of them from the previous debate, but the one I really wanted to see was last night's because I hadn't seen most of those candidates. So yeah. So I should catch some Cubs tomorrow, later tonight.
It's crazy. I only saw a little bit of the debate, and then I watched The Daily Show last night.
Yeah.
And obviously they covered it live. And I saw some of the clips. I don't understand how they're given 15 seconds.
Oh, man, I know. I was thinking the same thing. I mean, they've got to try to fit in answers from 10 candidates, though.
Right.
It'll get better because from what I've heard, by September, they're whittle it down to half of what we have now.
You can't have 1% or less. And you have to have a certain amount of money donated to your campaign or you're out.
Yeah, so we're gonna see a lot of them go away.
There's a lot of Jake Tapper going, you know, your time's up, your time's up, and a lot of people talking over each other and stuff like that. It's aggravating.
It's a tough job that those moderators have to keep it on the tracks, though, too. So I understand it, but it was annoying because 15 seconds.
I know, that's crazy.
By the time, but you know what?
How can you discuss?
You know what though? What I thought was, if you know the rules before you go in, you tailor your answers, you cut them down.
Yeah,
don't give the same political lines that you hear. Just get to the meat of what you want to say.
But the meat of what you want to say about policy should last longer than 15 seconds.
That's true, too.
So, anyway, we'll see what happens. We got a Cub game and a debate with 60 more candidates announced on the Democratic Party. So, all right, we're going to take a break, and the great Rich Coase, a.k.a. Sven Gulli, celebrating his 40th anniversary, is going to join us right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. You know that's a familiar theme. That, of course, is the theme to Sven Gulli, which you can see every Saturday night at 7 on MeTV. And it's always a blast. And Rich Coase is going to be at Flashback Weekend, as he is every year. But it's a special, you know, he's doing 2 days this year. Normally, he just does it the Saturday. He'll do photo ops, and he'll do signings, and then host the costume contest. But this year, it's special because this year celebrates Rich's 40th year doing Sven Gulli. And so there's some special stuff planned for Friday as well, and we'll tell you all about it right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Wednesday, Wildcard Wednesday. Get your request in now at 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about the essential golden age of horror and the 13 scariest CGI monsters, and then some very weird pop culture lawsuits. And we will also play Know Your Onion a little bit later on after the 4:30 news. So 312-981-7200. Okay, we are only a couple of days away from Flashback Weekend, Chicago's Horror Con. I've been a part of it since the beginning in 2002. I'm one of the weekend's hosts, and it's got a pretty amazing lineup this year. Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell, Lance Henriksen, Ted Raimi. There's a Night of the Creeps reunion featuring the director and Tom Atkins and the rest of the cast. We have a Candyman reunion with Tony Todd and Virginia Madsen. Robert Englund is going to be there, good old Freddy Krueger, and all the ladies of Elm Street are going to be there for a reunion. You got incredible photo ops, lots of really fun things happening. There's going to be like an after party at Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant. It's a full weekend. It starts Friday and it goes through Sunday, and it is going to be a blast. And there's also a great room full of vendors where you can get all kinds of horror paraphernalia and items and merchandise and apparel. It's a blast. Check out flashbackweekend.com. For all the schedules and information, all that cool stuff, and get your tickets now. It's at the Crown Plaza Hotel O'Hare in Rosemont, and it is a great, great time. It's always the weekend that I look forward to the most all year long. And to celebrate that, Rich Coase is joining us because he's going to be there this weekend, and we welcome Rich to the show. Rich, how are you?
I'm good. When you get to those class action suits, are you going to mention the one that somebody filed after we had the 3D movie on WFLD years ago?
Hold on a second. Somebody actually did file a class action suit?
Yeah, there was, because they felt that, you know, they expect to see seaweed, you know, with the creature from the Black Lagoon in the movie, and they expect to see seaweed or something, because the 3D was not good enough.
Well, I remember the whole thing, Rich, and these are things, obviously, that we're going to want to talk about because it's the 40th anniversary. And by the way, congratulations, Rich, 40 years doing Sven.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate it. Yeah, there were some gaps. I wasn't doing a program the whole time.
Right.
But even during the times when I was not doing a regularly scheduled program, people still had me doing appearances as Sven Gulli, or at that time, son of Sven Gulli.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I was still the character during that time. So
all right,
we're celebrating 40 years of me in bad makeup.
And I am so honored to be moderating 40 years of Sven Gulli on Friday night at 7 o'clock in the main ballroom. I'm so excited about that.
And I have to say that I'm glad that you're doing it, because I know you've been a fan of the show for a long time, and you know a lot about me and the show. And I think you'll bring out some questions that some people might not necessarily bring. So
yeah,
it's going to be interesting. It's going to be fun. I know we've been working on a few little video inserts for it. And I think it's going to be a great time.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it. And, of course, you'll be back on Saturday for the usual stuff, your photo ops, your signings. your selfies, and of course, you will be hosting the Sinister Visions costume contest. And I've said this before, Rich, for me, always the highlight of the weekend.
I know. I always appreciate that, you know, you're, as I've said before, you're one of the people there that gets all my jokes most of the time.
No, you kill every year. As soon as I introduce you, I have the honor of introducing you, I introduce you, and I go right down, sit in the front row and watch.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. I wanted to mention with those photo ops that I'm doing, they have those professional, nicely shot ones. First of all, we have a really nice background thing that looks like my coffin from the show.
Mm.
So that people will be able to have that in the photo as well. And also, we've made provisions so that anybody who gets those pictures will have a chance to have me sign them.
Yeah.
So on both days. We want to make sure that people know that it's going to be really nice.
They've got a whole set. And they're doing that for a lot of people. They've got like a, like Tony Todd's going to be in his Candyman costume.
Uh-huh.
They're going to have a full size boiler room set up for Robert Englund.
Right.
And,
oh man.
Yeah, and they're going to have the costumes, the people in costume from Night of the Creeps, and if you're getting a picture, your photo op taken with Lance Henriksen, you get to do it in front of a giant alien egg.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So they always
Lance
do that.
Lance is a riot, by the way.
He's fantastic.
Every time we've seen him, it's like, kind of like you never know what you're going to get, but you know it's going to be amusing.
Yeah.
And I remember last time we were interviewing him, because we usually, anytime he's there, we do something for the show with him.
Yeah.
And we were going through and talking, and all of a sudden he says, why are we always being so serious when we do these things?
Yeah.
and he has a great sense of humor.
He does.
So.
He does. I always, every year he's come to Flashback, I always moderate his Q&A. And I'll be doing it again this year. 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon is when you can see Lance's Q&A, and he's
got
some amazing stories. But all right, let's get back to so one of the many stories that have happened over the 40 years that you have been playing Sven is the legendary 3D story. And this comes up. This is sort of legendary. It's come up. It comes up all the time when we talk about you playing Sven Gulli, and I vividly remember getting my, you know, I think I had to, do we have to buy a Slurpee?
You had to buy something, but I think you could also get them for like 89 cents or something.
Right, right. So you get
and
your
it was
3D
at two different outlets. Was it like the 7-Eleven stores?
Yeah.
And I think maybe Dominick's.
Okay.
Back then.
Well, I remember getting mine at 7-Eleven, and I got my 3D glasses. All of my friends did too. And we were all ready to watch. Was it Return of the Creature or Creature from the Black Lagoon?
It was Revenge of the Creature.
Oh, Revenge of the Creature, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell everybody about this. How did the idea come up to show a 3D movie on the show?
Well, somebody along the way who was tied in with Universal, I guess, had gotten the rights to sell the 3D version to stations all around the country. So it's not like it just happened in Chicago. It happened in various other cities as well. And, you know, I don't know if they were hosted in all those cities, but in ours, you know, it fell to me because I was on the station and they figured it would be a natural thing.
Yeah.
And I remember we went out and we shot promos at Lincoln Park Zoo, you know, right at the lakefront.
Right.
We may have even gone to the Shedd Aquarium, but I don't remember for sure. But we did a whole string of these commercials, and we also had me as another character who was like a sort of newscaster or announcer guy who we shot because I'd always remind people, you know, put your 3D glasses on.
Right.
You know, because really people were going to be that dumb that they'd have the glasses. And then also we had to remind them to take them off when they were going to be commercials. You know, it was very funny.
Yeah.
So we got it all done, and we shot the stuff and everything. And I think one of the problems, I've been told all sorts of different stories, some I don't know if they're true or not. But I do know one thing is that they were really nervous because this was a big deal, and they had paid a lot into the advertisers and such, and they wanted to make sure it ran perfectly.
Right.
So instead of just running the movie off tape or whatever they had it on, and then, you know, the normal way is to add in commercials and things through, you know, a sort of computerized process that would drop the things in off different machines. Now, they were worried they didn't want anything to screw up, so they dubbed everything in order for air onto one tape. Now, when you dub things on videotape, You probably know this. A lot of times you lose a little bit of quality.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that was part of the problem. I had heard that our transmitter that night was not up to full power. And it's like, okay, that's two strikes.
Yeah.
But here's the thing that I think was the real problem. Back then, you didn't have remotes that you could adjust all the picture stuff with.
Right.
You know, you had the knobs for correcting most things on your TV were in the back of the TV.
Exactly.
And to get your TV set up so it would get the 3D perfectly, what you had to do, we ran this thing that ran only about a minute, I think. And you, what you were supposed to do was turn some sort of knobs, and I don't remember which ones, in the back of the screen,
right,
behind the set, until both sides of the picture looked the same.
Right.
Now, you know what that's like back then. You know, you've got, you know, dad in the back of the TV and the family in the front, and they're going, no, go back. No, the other way. You're no.
Right.
And so it was very difficult to get it figured out for a lot of people.
Yeah. And it didn't turn out well. I remember one fish was in 3D.
Yes. There were fish in the foreground. There was the big electric probe.
Right.
That they used underwater. You could see that. And the cardboard cutout of the creature that fell forward.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think those were the main effects. For some reason, it just didn't work very well.
Yeah.
But and for the year after that, I heard from people any time I'd do an appearance with, I want my 89 cents back.
Yeah, and you know what, Rich? You know, I know that you still receive those kind of things. I mean, it was in 1984 when you did that.
Yeah. And people still bring that up.
And people still bring it up. It's like, get over it. I mean, come on.
And yet, there are also people who say, why don't you do it again?
Yeah.
And the thing would be, you know, since we're on nationally, we'd have to find someone in every single market that ETV is in, and it's in 95% of the country,
right,
that would be willing to tie in with the whole thing and, you know, provide the glasses. And it's like, oh, man,
yeah, that would be
a real giant headache.
That's a huge undertaking, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I will say this, the technology is much better now.
And they even have the different type of 3D where you just use the polarized glass.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's not the old red and green Christmas-type colors.
Exactly. All right, Rich, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right, Rich Coase is with us. He's the best. Sven Gulli, celebrating 40 years of being Sven Gulli. And I am hosting an evening with Sven Gulli, remembering 40 years of Sven Gulli. And it's at the Flashback Weekend convention Friday night at 7 o'clock. You can get your photo op taken before that, too, at 6:30. And that's going to be at the Crown Plaza, Chicago, O'Hare, and Rosemount. We're going to be talking about Flashback Convention a lot for the next couple of mornings. And, in fact, Steve Procopi, who is also one of the hosts at Flashback for many years, is going to be with us tomorrow to reminisce and talk a little bit more about it. But we're going to come back and talk more with Rich Coase, Sven Gulli, right after this on 720 WGN.
Quick look and you can see the sound is just like Mayberry. And our hero has to jump when he meets Helen Crump. The old guy who first found the flop is Emmett from the fix-it shop. If this kid wasn't such a dope, he'd be a lot like Hope.
Yeah. Okay, we're back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It is Wednesday, so Wildcard Wednesday.
Yeah, man!
Get your requests in now. Any artist, any song, anything, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Since we're talking with Sven Gulli right now, the great Rich Coase, we're going to jump into some more little horror topics as well in honor of Flashback Weekend, the horror convention coming up. Starting on Friday, we're going to talk about the essential Golden Age horror and the 13 scariest CGI monsters, and then a little bit later on, weird pop culture lawsuits. But right now, we want to get back to our conversation with Rich Coase, a.k.a. Sven Gulli, celebrating 40 years of being the character, and I am honored to be hosting and moderating 40 years of Sven Gulli. It's a 90-minute show that Rich and I are going to be doing, and I'll be talking to Rich, and we'll probably open it up for Q&A, and that's at the Flashback Horror Convention, which is this weekend. Let's welcome Rich back. Rich, welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm always happy to be on with you, Nick.
I got to tell you, a couple of weeks ago, you know, when it was 100, and you remember a couple of weekends ago when it was like 105 degrees outside?
Yes, I recall that.
Okay,
yes.
I live in an apartment that only has one small window unit in my bedroom.
Ooh,
I ended up staying with my folks that weekend. And so we watched Svengoolie, all three of us together.
Oh, really?
Yeah, last Saturday night, and it was The Valley of the Giants, which is one of the weirdest of the weirdest movies I've ever seen in my life. My dad was like, "What am I watching?" He had you know, by the second time they repeated that long, ridiculous sort of dance sequence where they're all dancing.
Slow motion dance sequence.
Yeah.
Yes.
My dad was like, "What are we watching?" And we all had a great time. We all laughed at all the bits that you did in between. But that is one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, we kind of felt like it's one of those beach movies without the beach.
Yeah,
basically, and it's they said it was based on the old H.G. Wells Food of the Gods.
Yeah.
But just barely, I would say.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, I love showing movies like that just because they are so bizarre. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, like you said, that you're sitting there going, what is this?
Yeah.
Am I really watching this?
Yeah.
And we did add, you know, some, as we call it, spin surround to it, batting sound effects and such. And there were people who complained about it.
Yeah, I don't understand. I think spin surround is hilarious. I mean, I think it's hilarious, especially with a movie that's that ridiculous. I mean, I'm sure Bo Bridges is thrilled it's on his resume.
Oh my God, yeah, you know, and Ron Howard is sitting there going, "Yes, I've directed some great movies, but none as big as."
Yeah, well, we were, you know, it was just, it's hilarious, you know, it's just so hilarious to watch, and it's such a weird one. And then, you know, then last week you show one of the best. You showed Forbidden Planet last week, which is just an absolute classic.
I love that movie, and I'm so happy that we had a chance to show it. And the thing that I was happiest about, quite honestly, is that movie is very, very long.
Yeah.
The time that it takes is actually longer than the time that is usually allotted to me and the movies altogether. So we minimized what I did, certainly, but also we had to edit the movie, which I hate to do, especially with something as good as that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And excuse me. The thing is, you know, we don't do, you remember some TV stations that would edit movies by simply chopping off a whole sequence or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I remember, Rich, when Channel 7 used to do the 3:30 movie every weekday from 3:30 to 5, and they would do Ape Week, and so they would show all five of the Planet of the Apes movies.
Right,
The first Planet of the Apes movie is like 2 hours and 5 minutes long, and they had to fit it into a 90-minute time schedule with commercials. So they would just chop tons of stuff out.
Yeah, and that's something I always remember when we are faced with having to cut down a movie. We do all sorts of cuts on it. I go through it and figure out where it can be cut, and there's times when, you know, we're trying to literally match the music or sounds in it to make it so it won't be noticeable. And my director and chief editor, Chris Faulkner, is a genius with this kind of stuff. He can, you know, I can find an edit that kind of works, and he'll make it so it's perfect, and you almost can't tell there was an edit there. And, you know, we take out, you know, we're trying to do this with maintaining the integrity of the movie, and there's times when we do edits that are as short as 9 seconds.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, we try to make up the time and, you know, keep the story together and not get rid of anything really important that, you know, is important to the plot of the movie. And I'm happy that we succeeded, because there were people that said, "Oh, I noticed there were edits," but nobody was going like, "Oh, you butchered it," which they do sometimes when we do edit even lesser movies.
Yeah. Well, it's tough to, you know, to fit all that stuff in, and I know how much work you put into it. I've had the privilege of coming down to the studio a few times and, you know, and being on set and watching you guys put that show together, and the amount of work that you in particular, Rich, do is kind of mind boggling. That you do that for every show.
Well, you know, that's my job.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's,
and you know, people always think that we have like a huge staff that's doing all this stuff, and, you know, and the fact is, it's me screening the movie and, you know, figuring out the segments and where the edits have to be and everything. There, you know, and I write the stuff for the show and perform it, and then help with the post-production and find the clips that we have to insert and things like that.
Sure, sure.
There's me, then there's my director who directs in the studio, Chris Faulkner, and he's also the chief editor, and he's editing things together.
Yeah.
And there's my executive producer, Jim Roach, who's had to say hello to you, by the way.
Yes, good old Jim. I'll see him this weekend, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, he's helping out with things, and then the other only real full-time type person is, of course, Hit the Theme Chaz Alling, our audio guy.
Right.
Yeah. And he is right in there, and that's it. You know, we also have, you know, whoever they assign to us as a floor manager, who's the person that just, you know, times some of the segments and gives me cues, and then somebody to run the teleprompter.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's a great operation. I've seen it up close and personal, and it's pretty great. And I was lucky enough to throw chickens at you, and I was the hand at the door.
Yes, sir.
A couple times, which is always a blast. And by the way,
you were a student.
That's right.
When we did the one Marx Brothers.
When you
movie.
Did Duck Soup.
Yes.
No, it wasn't Duck Soup. It was
Horse Feathers.
Horse Feathers, right? Because that's the college one, right?
You're right. Yes.
I got to do a bit with you on camera, which was fantastic.
That's
fantastic.
But, well, you know, you were nominated for an Emmy.
Thank you.
That.
I realize that, and I owe it all to you, Rich.
Well, at least I could do.
I do want to mention the one that you're showing this Saturday, which I will not be able to watch. I'll have it on my DVR waiting for me. I won't be able to watch it because I have stuff to do at the convention.
Well, naturally, yeah.
But it's Peter Cushing. There's a Peter Cushing movie on this Saturday. Oh, my God.
He's one of your favorites. Yes. I know that. It's the evil of Frankenstein.
Yeah, it's a great
one. It is, and it's so interesting because there's a lot of different things there. You know, they thought that the doctor was dead, but he really isn't, and he's running a clinic someplace for the good of mankind.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, he's still doing his experiments.
Yeah,
which I guess he feels are for the betterment of mankind too.
Yeah.
And along the way, you know, he ends up in big trouble again, but he also, you know, discovers his old monster.
Yeah.
Along the way, and tries to find out there's a character who's really a jerk in it. It's like this hypnotist.
Yeah.
Remember him?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, it's got everything. It's got a mute girl. It's got, you know, monsters. It's got monkeys. You know, you can't beat that.
You can't beat that. And it's got Peter Cushing, which is for my money. That's the deal. I loved, you know, I mean, the Hammer movies were kind of, you know, Rich, like a lot of people. When I was a little kid, it was the Universal movies, and I watched Creature Features, and I watched Jerry G. Bishop,
as the
original Sven.
Yeah.
But as soon as I saw the Hammer movies, something in me changed. You know what I mean? Like, I was used to all the Universal, the black and white, the moody stuff, and then all of a sudden, here's all this incredible bright Technicolor, and there's blood, and there's boobs, and everything, and Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, and I was just like, wow. And it was the same characters, obviously, the same monsters and creatures, but they completely different take.
Yeah, it was almost like moving into a whole new era of horror movies.
Yeah.
Because it was different from, you know, the Universal stuff, where a lot of stuff was more suggested than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you know, mainly the black and white. But here you had, exactly. It's like that. It's like opening up a comic book with all the bright colors and everything.
Yeah.
And, they were not afraid to show some cleavage and and blood and guts.
Yeah.
It was quite, I think most people considered it much racier than the Universal stuff, sir.
Without question, yeah. And then, and I also loved, you know, because you're showing a Frankenstein film. I loved Peter Cushing's really dark interpretation of playing Frankenstein.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, he's really evil. In many of the Hammer Frankenstein movies.
Yes, he really is, and it's, you know, while you had Colin Clive, who was, you know, this sort of torn between, you know, working on this stuff and doing the right thing, and, you know, he was getting so frantic and having mental breakdowns.
Yeah.
And, you know, no such thing with Peter Cushing.
No.
He knows what he's doing, and he's got a reason he wants to do it.
Yeah.
And it isn't always, as I said, for the betterment of mankind.
Yeah. So it's a great one. That's up on this Saturday. Hey, Rich, hang on, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, Rich Coase is with us. He is the one, the only Sven Gulli, and he is awesome. And I am privileged and honored to moderate 40 years of Sven Gulli, which is going to be at the Crowne Plaza Hotel Flashback Weekend horror convention, and that's Friday night at 7 o'clock. Get there early at 6:30, get your picture taken, photo op with Sven in front of the coffin, and then he'll be back on Saturday, too. A full weekend of fun at the Flashback Weekend begins on Friday. All right, we'll take a quick break, and we'll talk more with Rich after this on 720 WEG.
Our death bay is near Helen. He'll lure her to his mommy's den, 'cause he's sure that she's on some amen. Ardiff Bay wants her again. He, of course, is Imhotep. Junior read the scroll, 'cause yeah. He's in
it. It's the best, man. I love watching Svengoolie. Every Saturday night, 7 o'clock, I am there. And the one and only Svengoolie, Rich Coase, celebrating 40 years of being Svengoolie. Please come out to the Flashback Weekend Horror Convention. Rich is going to be there both on Friday and Saturday. Saturday for the usual stuff that he does, the photo ops, the signings, and then hosting the Sinister Visions costume contest on Saturday afternoon, which is always a blast. But he'll also be there Friday. Special photo opportunities Friday evening. And at 7 o'clock, I am so unbelievably excited to moderate the evening with Svengoolie, celebrating 40 years. It's going to be really a lot of fun. We'll have some clips, and we'll be live on stage, and it's going to be great. You can get your tickets now at flashbackweekend.com. Also, Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell, Lance Hendrickson, Ted Raimi, Night of the Creeps reunion, Candyman reunion with Tony Todd, Virginia Madsen. So many other great things and screenings and all kinds of fun, and it's just going to be a blast. And Robert Englund and the ladies of Elm Street, they're going to have a reunion as well. So it's going to be a great time. Rich, welcome back.
Thank you. You know, talking about Robert Englund, I'm really looking forward to seeing him again. I've been so honored that he has said that I'm his favorite horror show host.
Yeah.
And also Amanda Wiss, who I keep in touch with after meeting her a few years ago. She's a lot of fun. And, man, I'm hoping I get a chance to meet Bruce Campbell. Because
you've never met him? Oh my God, you've never met Bruce. Well, I'll tell you something. It's been a really long time since he's been at Flashback. The last time he was at Flashback was 2005.
Oh man.
So it's been 14 years. Now he did something in 2010 at Mike and Mia's drive-in, the Midway drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
He did come out to that, but his last time at Flashback was 2005. So it's been a really, really long time since I've seen Bruce too, and I'm very excited to see him again. And I'm going to lose my mind when I meet Sam Raimi.
I'm hoping to meet him too. I know we talked to his brother, Ted Raimi.
Yeah.
Was that 2 years ago?
He'll be there. He'll be there this year as well.
Oh, is he?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah. It's going to be great. And this is the first time Sam has ever done the Flashback convention. So we're very excited to have him there. And so many other great, like Tom Atkins is so great to talk to, too. I know you've interviewed Tom Atkins on the show, too.
Yeah, he's always a lot of fun. He makes me laugh. And I just remember one of the last times I talked to him, he said, you know, my sister called me up and she says, you're on Svengoolie right now. he's great. There's so many cool people to meet there. Yeah. And Tony Todd, no matter how many times he's been there, I have never crossed paths with him there.
And Virginia Madsen. From Chicago, it'll be her first time.
I really would like to meet, and the reason for that is I remember reading in an article she was talking about how she and her son would watch old horror movies together, and I was wondering if they were watching it on my show.
Yeah, I bet that would be the case. I would imagine. I just think I love her, and I know that it's weird. I know she's, you know, it's a horror convention, but I'm bringing my poster from Sideways for her to sign.
Why not?
Which is one of my favorite movies of all time. So now, Rich, we'll dive into all of the, you know, the fun stuff, the history of the character and everything. But one more time, you know, remind everybody the story of how you got it. And you started writing jokes for the great Jerry G. Bishop, who was the original Svengoolie back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, he started, I think, in 1970, because that was right after I had graduated from high school and was about to go to Northwestern. And he started in that fall, and he was just the voiceover announcer who happened to be on duty, because at the time, all TV stations had live voiceover announcers who would do different announcements, obviously. Mm-hmm. And he started to just fool around when he was doing the breaks of the movie, the Friday Night Horror movie, and started doing the accent, and after a while was doing his shtick just like he did on the radio, using the sound effects and stuff.
Yeah.
And he was encouraging people to write in and send him jokes and things. things. And so I did. I was just a big fan of his from his radio work and everything else. And he liked what I sent him. And when he found out that I was a broadcasting student, he you know, kind of took an interest in it. And he liked the stuff I was sending him. He'd start to ask me to, you know, write certain things. You know, like, can you do a parody of this commercial that's running right now, and little song parody things and things like that. And, you know, again, talk about a generous man. He could have just taken that stuff and said, hey, thanks a lot, kid, and done nothing.
Yeah.
But he actually opened the door for me to work with him, and not only there, but also in radio. And, you know, after his show had been canceled, we were working in radio, and one of his friends at one of the TV stations said to him, you know, would you want to do Svengoolie just as like a summer thing, just as a lark, as a fill-in type thing during the summer? And at the time, Jerry said, no, I don't really think I want to. But he was the one that suggested, why don't you, me, be the son of Svengoolie? And, you know, I can produce the show, and, you know, we can do that. And I was all for it, certainly, and very flattered that he would entrust me with, you know, picking up the torch on the character. And we had false starts on that, and nothing ever happened with it. And time passed, and he ended up getting a job in San Diego.
Right.
As he was about to head out there, he said, well, what are you going to do? And I'd been, you know, just freelancing, and everybody I'd freelanced with were moving their company to the West Coast, but I was not quite ready to do that. And I said, well, maybe I'll try to, you know, sell somebody on a TV show here, one of the local stations. And he said, I tell you what, if you want to do the Son of Svengoolie thing, if you can get that going, you have my blessing.
Oh.
And that was it. And he, you know, pretty much handed the keys to it over to me, never asked for anything back.
Yeah.
And, you know, from everything I know, he was very proud of what I've done.
Yeah.
And so I shopped it around and eventually got it on the air at WFLD.
And then when did you become actual just Sven? When did you become Svengoolie?
That was when Neil Saban, the man who created MeTV and changed WCIU into the U.
Yeah.
When he was starting WCIU as, you know, one of the type of independent TV stations like we all grew up watching.
Yeah.
And like Channel 32 was at first. And I was his first talent hire, I believe. We met for lunch one day and just really hit it off and, you know, connected on so many different things. And he said, you know, well, we don't want to do the Co-Zone, which was the semi-kids show that I did over at
right.
WFLD.
Right.
And he said, would you mind doing the Svengoolie character again? And I said, you know, Neil, never does a week go by that somebody doesn't recognize me and say to me, are you ever going to do that again? Because I really liked it.
Yeah.
And I've often repeated, you know, if it meant that much to people, and as it seems to mean that much to them now, it's like, how could I turn that down?
Yeah. And there, and then that's it. And you've been Svengoolie ever since. And it's just great. I just, I every time I hear the story of your relationship with Jerry G. Bishop, it to me reminds me of the relationship I had with Roy Leonard.
Sure,
because he totally took me under his wing and taught me so much, and I was just this young jerk, you know. and then, you know, I mean, I it's a very you know, it's a similar kind of relationship that you had with Jerry G. Bishop, which I always
definitely think so. Yeah, and I always remember Jerry had a, I think it was like an autobiographical book written by Dick Cavett.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, here, you should read this. And I did, and it was interesting. There were little things in there I picked up on. And he said, you know, there are certain things in there that, you know, where he talks about how, you know, people will always tell people that they've changed when they, you know, become famous or something. And he said that you know, there's reasons that you have to change somewhat.
Yeah.
He said, and, you know, I want you to understand that. So he must have figured that I'd go on to something.
Yeah.
But, both. And again, yeah, Roy, of course, another great guy, terrific broadcaster,
yeah.
And again, really a good guy.
Yeah, no question about it. No question. I mean, I've said this a million times. I pretty much owe my entire career to him.
Owe mine to Jerry. Yeah. I always make that clear to people, you know, because there are still people who say, oh, well, you kind of, you know, you stole his character.
No.
And it's like, no, actually, he was the one that wanted me to do this. He was the one that first thought of me doing it.
Yeah. And you still have the old sound effects. And as I've told you many times, Rich, my favorite is ow, ow, ow. That's my favorite That's, every time I hear that, it just cracks me up every single time.
And there are some that still, even though I've heard them so many times, yeah. will make me laugh yeah. as well.
Yeah.
And one of the fun things, you know, again, I would talk about our audio guy, Chaz. He will throw certain things in that I'm not expecting.
Right.
And will just, it'll crack me up. He's a very clever guy and very quick with this stuff.
Yeah.
So, and that's not only when we're actually on camera, but as we're setting up shots and stuff, you know, my mic is open and we're talking about something, I'll say something. And he'll do things like hit the sound effect for the music for the NBC thing, The More You Know.
Right.
And all sorts of just little things, but it helps, you know, it really makes the whole process. Yeah, it's work, but it's so much fun. I'm working with great guys and gals who really, you know, get what we're doing.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, you know, people are assigned to shows, and they don't care about them. They're doing their job.
Right.
And not to say that they don't care about their job and doing it well, but it's like they don't really have any real ties to their program.
Right.
But, you know, here's these guys, and, you know, they live it as much as I do.
Yeah.
And they want it to be good, and they go out of their way to make it better, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and it's great, Rich. Consistently, you know, I have a blast every Saturday night watching your show. It's just yep. one of my favorite things. So we're gonna have a great time this weekend, Rich, and I'm really really excited about Friday night. That's at 7 o'clock in the main ballroom. I'll be moderating it. 40 years of Svengoolie. You got some clips that we're gonna show, and mm-hmm. We'll talk to the audience and all that cool stuff. And then you'll come back on Saturday for your signings, photo op, and of course the hilarious Sinister Visions costume contest. And it's all flashbackweekend.com. Tickets are available right now. Go to flashbackweekend.com for tickets, information, and an entire schedule. It's going to be a busy, fun weekend. All right, we'll take a break here on 720 and WGN.
Clang, 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 went the trolley. Ding, 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 went the bell. Sing, 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 went my heartstrings as we started for Huntington Day.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Wednesday. That means Wildcard Wednesday here, man. And that's any artist, any song, anything. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Get your requests in now, and we'll play them later. Tom, who requested that?
That's coming to us from Dino.
Okay. There you go. All right. You know, always fun to talk to Rich. He's just such a legend and a great guy. It's going to be fun to do that 40th anniversary thing. It's going to be 90 minutes long too. So we're going to have some great clips and, we'll talk to the audience and it's going to be good. And, flashbackweekend.com again for all the information. So, but I figured we would, continue talking about since, you know, Sven has been doing this for 40 years and over the course of those years, he has shown some classic horror films. And some not so classic, like we were talking Valley of the Giants from the other week, which is a really horrendously weird movie. But he always has fun, you know, with those, because it's always fun to watch Sven. And, you know, to me, the movie's secondary. If it's a great movie, I'm very happy. If it's a terrible movie, I'm also happy because I'm watching Svengoolie. And, you know, the bits that he does in between and the jokes that he tells going in and out of the commercials and stuff, always classic. So it's always great to watch no matter what. If the movie's bad, I don't care. If the movie's great, it's an extra treat. Just like we said last week, Forbidden Planet, which is a great, legitimately great movie. And then this week, The Evil Frankenstein, the Hammer movie. But I figured we'd continue to talk about some horror movies, considering we are on our way to the Flashback Horror Convention for this weekend. And jump into the... By the way, again, I just want to let people know that I'm off Friday morning. I will not be on Friday morning. So we'll have to save the regular features for the following week. And it's Dane Neal who's filling in.
Yeah, Dane's going to be coming in on Friday.
And then on Monday morning, I'm also off because I will be at the hotel. I'll check into the hotel on Friday, and I won't leave until Sunday evening. And we're not doing any outdoor screenings this year at Flashback. We've been doing outdoor screenings, but we're not going to do them. The screenings that they're going to be showing are going to be inside. And there's a bunch of them this year. But two big ones where it'll be Robert Englund you know, having a little talk and a Q&A, and then he'll introduce the original Nightmare, because Nightmare on Elm Street is 35 years old this year. If people can fathom that, Nightmare on Elm Street's 35 years old this year. So we're going to celebrate the 35th anniversary of showing that movie. And then practically everybody who's involved in Night of the Creeps, Fred Decker, the director, Tom Atkins, Jason Lively. Almost the entire cast, the major players are going to be there. And so they're going to do a big Q&A with the cast and the director, and then they're going to show that on Saturday night.
That's just thrilling.
Yeah. Thrill me. Night of the Creeps, which is a really terrific movie. So it's going to be a fun weekend all the way around, and I'll be running around like a lunatic the entire time there. That's why I'm going to take Monday off. So, but I thought we could talk about the golden age of horror films. Obviously Rich has shown many of these, and has shown a lot of the classic, the real classic Universal films as well. But it goes back even before that. So morbidlybeautiful.com has put together what they think are the top 8 essential golden age horror films in honor of Flashback, in honor of Sven. So if you guys want to jump in here, what are your favorite golden age of horror movies? And I'll give you a little background on this, and then we'll talk about them and why they're important and why these specific movies are essential and so important in the world of the horror genre, and why they are the epitome of the golden age. So if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. They say Eerie Essentials, 8 important and influential films from the golden age of horror that every single genre fan should see. These are must-sees. So 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you want to jump in here. 312-981-7200. Horror films are juxtaposed metaphorical manifestations of monsters. Jason Voorhees and Michael Myers lumbering around respectively in their Friday the 13th and Halloween films. They simply do not die. You can go back to the 1896 short film, which is known as The House of the Devil or The Haunted Castle, which unknowingly launched the horror film genre. This was in 1896. It was the first motion picture to present macabre elements like haunted houses, bats, and cauldrons to the fledgling world of movies, and it marked the infancy of scary films. In over 120 years that time has passed, the Haunted Castle's Paris premiere, the horror film genre has flourished and become cinema-centric for a world of rabid fans, indulging in everything from the Universal Monsters of the Golden Era to Vincent Price's collection of creepy classics like House of Wax, House on Haunted Hill, and The Tingler. Hammer horror that added color and blood to the exploits of Dracula and Frankenstein, Hitchcockian masterpieces like Psycho and the Birds, and then slasher icons including Freddy Krueger, Leatherface, Chucky, and Pinhead. And then the slatter ghost story culture of Saw and Insidious and things like that that are now the modern way to go. But it's the golden age that sets the wheels in motion. So here's a list of the 8 most influential, horrifying, and entertainment macabre movies from the earliest days of cinema, and several little-known facts that could quench your trivia thirst. These are must-see for all scary movie aficionados, and we've got some really fun trivia about each one. So these are in chronological order, and this is the beginning of the golden age of horror and scary movies. I have absolutely seen every one of these, and multiple times as well. And we want to hear from you. Golden age of horror, what do you think? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1920. Tom, you've seen this, right?
Yeah, we would show it at the new 400.
Oh, really?
Because we would do our scare fest, but it's kind of hard to secure the rights to a lot of movies. It takes a lot of time. So what we decided we would do is show public domain classics, usually Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Night of the Living Dead, and Nosferatu, because we wanted to do something unique, show movies that people had never seen or hadn't seen on the big screen.
The Captain of Dr. Caligari is a pretty amazing film. Here's what they say about it. 97 years ago, the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari opened in Berlin. The film is a sterling example of German expressionism, which found fruition just prior to the First World War. The movie revolves around the evil Dr. Caligari, played by Werner Krauss, who uses young Caesar, Conrad Veidt, to carry out his diabolical deeds. And even though it's a silent picture, Caligari remains one of the best early representations of the horror genre and is a must-see for any enthusiast. And if you ever get a chance to see it, if you ever get a chance to see it with Jay Warren, the great Jay Warren, accompanying it on the big organ, the Wurlitzer, it's pretty special. It's pretty great. We've had Jay on many, many times. You know, he's one of the guys that runs the Silent Film Society here in Chicago and has been an organ accompanist in cinema for, I don't even know how many years. He's the guy to go to. If you're going to show a silent film, you get him to play the Wurlitzer. Here's some trivia. Caligari is well known as the first full-length horror film. Actor Conrad Veidt went on to and played Major Strasser 22 years later in the classic Casablanca. Hey, by the way, you know the guy who played the director Sam Wanamaker in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that he was Friedrich, the kid singer in Sound of Music?
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, so, I mean, he cast a bunch of people that had, you know, like Tarantino cast a bunch of people that had sort of lineage and history with classic Hollywood. He was in Sound of Music. He was one of the kids in Sound of Music.
He was one of the Von Trapps?
Yeah. He was Friedrich.
Friedrich Von Trapp. Oh my gosh.
That was him. Now he's playing Sam Wanamaker, the director. And he's fantastic.
Job. Yeah.
He's fantastic in it. The screenwriter of Caligari, Hans Janowitz, got the idea for the story after attending a carnival and discovering that a young girl was killed there. Most of the sets that you see in the film were made of painted paper. And the actors were paid approximately $30 a day for the shoot. That's pretty good money for 1920.
Yeah.
$30 a day?
Yeah.
That's pretty good money, man. So there's some facts about the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. A really tremendous and genuinely creepy movie.
And that really kicked off one of, if not the first artistic movement in film, which was German Expressionism.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not only the first full-length horror film, but it's German Expressionism gave people so many ideas that we still use to this
day.
Well,
I mean, it's one of the most influential horror films ever made. And then German Expressionism really did influence a lot of filmmakers that came after. So, wait, we got Fly Jams John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Nick?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. A classic movie, The House of Frankenstein.
House of Frankenstein is a great one.
Beautiful.
It's a great one, and it's got an all-star sort of lineup. Of monsters and creatures and universal characters. It's like a best of. All right, thanks. All right, here we go. Thank you, John. Thanks for the call. Okay. Let's see. We got some texts coming in, and if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 804 area code says anything with Boris, Bela, or Lon. Yeah, those are your three classic guys. Yeah, I mean, you know, Lon Chaney Jr. played every Universal monster at one point. He portrayed every single Universal monster at some point.
When was he Dracula?
He was Dracula in I don't want to say House of Dracula, but he was Dracula in two movies, I think, or one. And he was the Wolfman. Obviously, he was the Wolfman. He was the Mummy. He was Frankenstein. He was Frankenstein's monster. So he played the big ones. He played all the. At one point, Lon Chaney Jr. played all of the major of the major Universal monsters.
Yeah, it was Son of Dracula.
Son of Dracula.
Yeah, and he was Count Alucard.
Well, backwards.
Backwards, yeah. Dracula.
Nobody misses that.
Love it. So, Dr. Acula.
Exactly. All right, let's take a quick break, and we are talking about the Golden Age of Horror in honor of Flashback and in honor of Svengoolie. And these are movies that still influence people to this day. These are classics. And if you haven't seen these, you gotta see them. You gotta see them. Welcome back, everybody. Wildcard Wednesday. What's that? Who requested that?
That's Kathy. Wanted to hear the Beluga Whale Lullaby.
Okay. No idea. That sentence makes no sense to me. All right. There you go. Wildcard Wednesday. You've been Wildcard Wednesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. When we're talking about essential Golden Age horror movies that are still important today, that are still making an impact, that have influenced tons and tons of films that followed. Nosferatu is next, from 1922, directed by F.W. Murnau. The first feature film adaptation of Dracula follows the evil Count Orlok, played by Max Schreck, as he unleashes his hideous vampire powers on his unsuspecting prey. Although the characters have different names, Nosferatu is a direct ripoff of author Bram Stoker's novel Dracula. A vampire's weakness to sunset appears to be the first time Nosferatu, when the evil Count Orlok is vanquished at the film's conclusion. All prints and negatives of the movie were ordered destroyed after the widow of Stoker won her lawsuit against the filmmakers. However, the film survived as it slowly began to surface in other countries. Nosferatu was banned in Sweden because of its violent content. In 1972, the ban was finally lifted. 1972?
Seems a little late.
50 years that movie was banned? Wow. Count Orlok, a.k.a. Count Dracula, only appears on screen for approximately 9 minutes. The actor who plays Count Orlok, named Max Schreck, that's the word Schreck means fright in German.
Hmm.
Did you see Shadow of the Vampire?
No.
You haven't seen Shadow of the Vampire?
No.
Got to see Shadow.
Doesn't even ring a bell.
Oh, it's about the making of the movie.
Oh, well, that's interesting. It's all about Nosferatu?
It's all about the making of Nosferatu.
I got to see that.
Willem Dafoe plays Max Schreck. John Malkovich plays Murnau.
Really?
Oh yeah, you got to see this
movie.
No. You got to see this movie, man. You gotta. From 2000, maybe 2000, 2001, early 2000.
That sounds early awesome. 2000.
It's fantastic. Shadow of the Vampire.
What's your read on the Werner Herzog version?
I love it. I think it's great. I think Kinski's fantastic in it.
Oh. He's so crazy.
Yeah, but no, you got to see. Yeah, Klaus Kinski's nuts. That kind of goes without saying. Klaus Kinski's insane. There's, and I love him. You know, when you're hanging out with you get those two guys together. You know, you get Herzog and Kinski together. That's a party.
Didn't they make a movie about those two?
Yeah.
My Best Fiend or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah, those guys are nuts. There's no question about it. No, but you got to see Shadow of the Vampire. I'm trying to remember who directed it, and I'm going to go nuts. I can't.
Let's see here. Directed by E. Elias Merhige.
Oh, okay.
John Malkovich and Willem Dafoe, yeah?
Yeah, it's a great movie. What year?
2000.
Okay. So you should check that one out, man. Okay, next here on the essentials is obviously The Phantom of the Opera, which I've also had the pleasure of seeing Jay Warren accompany. He's done that one. He can do that one in his sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. A mysterious phantom played by Lon Chaney haunts the Paris Opera and sets his sights on a lovely ingenue Christine played by Mary Philbin. 93 minutes long. Did you ever see Argento's version of Phantom of the Opera?
Oh, God. I'm guessing this is late period Argento. Whereabouts was he doing that?
It's mid-period Argento. It's not terrible.
Let's see, 13% on Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah. I don't think it's terrible. It's not as bad as Dracula 3D, which is easily the worst movie he ever directed. But his latter stuff, although I love Mother of Tears, I know a lot of people hate Mother of Tears. I think Mother of Tears is great. And kind of a fitting end to the trilogy of Suspiria, Inferno, and then Mother of Tears. Mm-hmm. But I like Mother of Tears a lot. It's absolutely nuts, though. I mean, it's a completely insane movie. But it's Argento. And Udo Kier's death scene is unbelievable in that movie. And Ostia's in it, so it gets a, you know... he really, you know, I'll tell you something. Ostia really, really, as far as appearance goes, really took after her mother. And definitely not her father.
Thank God.
Definitely not her father.
Oh, boy.
Because Ozzy's beautiful, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Dario?
Yeah, not so much.
He's Dario Argento.
Yeah. here's some trivia about the Phantom of the Opera. Lon Chaney became well known for developing his own makeup for many of his characters, as he did, in fact. He used egg membranes on his eyeballs to make them look cloudy. He also employed fish skin and a bald cap to create the skeletal look on his face.
Ooh.
Did you ever see The Man of a Thousand Faces?
No.
Oh, man. It's about Lon Chaney, man. Gotta see it. When the Phantom reveals his face to Christine, the horrified reaction of actress Mary Philbin is genuine and not acting. According to cinematographer Charles Van Eeger, Chaney kept his makeup a secret until the last moment, so Philbin was, in fact, startled at his grotesque appearance. And by the way, this is true. When he reveals, you know, when he reveals his face in that infamous moment, it caused widespread fainting in theaters. People had never seen anything like it, and there was people passing out all over in movie theaters everywhere. Like they were like, ah! And that was it. They'd never seen anything like it.
So, oh my!
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
All right, let's take a break. We got the news coming up. More facts about the Phantom of the Opera and more unbelievably essential Golden Age horror. Wow, man, who requested Reflex?
Coming to us from none other than Ike.
Ike, man, going deep into the early 80s.
Yeah.
I saw them open up for the Police. Reflex, Politics of Dancing. They only had the one album, I think. And I love that album. I used to listen to it constantly.
Yeah, I had to pull this one from the Atomic Blonde soundtrack.
Yeah, oh yeah, it is in Atomic Blonde. Boy, that was a great soundtrack.
Yeah.
Movie was eh.
The action was good.
Well, the fight scene in the stairwell is unbelievable. And a couple of car chases are pretty great. But the movie overall, you know.
Not their finest.
Nah. But, I liked Charlize Theron in it.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you know, the sequels to Fury Road are coming out.
Yeah.
They're going to get made.
Which is
the greatest news in the history of anything. I will say this. You know, we were talking about how, Fate of the Furious wasn't one of the best of those movies. One of the reasons why is you have Furiosa in your movie and you don't put her behind the wheel of a truck or a car.
Yeah, she's pretty much just in that.
She stands
the whole
time. She stands there in front of video screens for the entire movie, and then she jumps out of a plane at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But she's back for the ninth one.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
How do you not? First of all, how do you not call the movie The Fast and the Furiosa? First of all, how do you not do that? You have to. Second of all, you put her behind a rig. Third of all, you get rid of one of her arms. That's the, you have to. So basically, I'm saying you just put Furiosa in the damn movie.
Here's what you do:
shave her head, put oil on her face,
You take the movie out, you put in Fury Road,
and, you, yeah,
and then you're good. Now you have Fast and the Furious.
Yeah. But no, seriously, though, on a serious note, if you're putting the, you're putting the actress who is playing one of the most iconic, like, action characters ever, who is a badass behind the wheel, you put her in a Fast and Furious movie, and you do not put her behind the wheel of a car or a truck. And I'm serious about that. You just don't have to play Furiosa.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to. You put Charlize Theron in your movie. You put her behind the wheel of a car.
Yeah,
that's what those movies are about. Putting people behind the wheels of cars and driving fast and smashing stuff.
Yeah, who knows what the ninth one's going to be called?
It's called Fast and Furious 9.
That's it.
Yeah, that's what. At least that's what it says now. I mean, they may change it.
I did appreciate that they tried to do something with the eighth one, Fate of the Furious.
You mean title wise?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not very good, though. And Hobbs and Nobbs comes out this weekend. Where, as I told you, Idris Elba is a robot. Now, they don't go into detail. They showed a clip. And he's got, like, they do it from his point of view during a fight scene where he's fighting both Hobbs and Nobbs. Where Idris Elba's fighting them. And he's got, like, Terminator stuff. Like, they show it from his point of view, from his eyes, and it's like he's sizing up. You know how the Terminator is sizing up people?
Yeah, he's got, like, the
He's got the readouts,
yeah.
And that's all. And I'm like, well, okay, so he's a robot. So now they have robots in these movies now.
Sweet.
All right. So we're talking about the absolute essential golden age horror films. We want to hear from you. We talked to Sven Gulli a little bit earlier, who's shown many of these things. We're going to see him this weekend at the great Flashback convention, the Flashback Weekend Horror Convention, where there's going to be an unbelievable guest list. And you can check out flashbackweekend.com for a full schedule and tickets. And I highly suggest that you come out. It's always a great time. It's always my favorite weekend of the year. Flashbackweekend.com. Let's get back to Phantom of the Opera from 1925. Some of the other trivia facts about it. The Phantom was a very unusual looking, he has a very unusual looking bed in the film, and it was used again later as Gloria Swanson's bed in Sunset Boulevard. I did not know that. In 1930, a sound version of the Phantom of the Opera was released, and it grossed another $1 million for Universal Pictures. Sadly, this talkie no longer exists and is considered a lost film. Oh. Oh. That's too bad. And when director Robert Julian was approached to helm the project, he simply said, "Lon Chaney, or it can't be done." Well, that makes sense.
It's true.
All right, next. This is such a great film. From 1931. Movie way ahead of its time. Directed by Fritz Lang, the film follows the psychopath Hans Beckert, played by Peter Lorre, the great Peter Lorre, the devilish child killer, continually eludes the police, but the tide turns when other criminals join in on the manhunt. Yeah, this is a movie that was for, you know, since 1931 this movie was made. The subject matter was not covered in the early this kind of this, like, a subject matter of, like, serial killers and stuff.
I mean, the concept of a serial killer literally didn't exist.
Yeah,
they didn't really understand, like, what a serial killer was, and this is the first depiction of anything like that.
It's a great film. The film's serial killer is played by none other than actor Peter Lorre, who went on and enjoyed success. As a successful Hollywood career in pivotal roles in Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon, and Casino Royale. Don't forget about the Patsy, directed by the great Jerry Lewis. Peter Lorre is fantastic in that movie.
Or the original The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah. M is considered the great granddaddy of slasher films, while Psycho ranks as the granddaddy and Halloween is the father of the subgenre. More trivia about M. Nazis banned the movie in July of 1934, so the German film could not be seen in its country of origin. Wow. The film only took 6 weeks to film. Prior to M, Peter Lorre was best known for his work as a comedic actor. That's true. M is short for Mörder, which means murderer in German. Yeah, if you've not seen this one, this is a It's kind of out there too. It's and Lori's performance is just crazy. So, all right, 1931, Dracula, directed by Todd Browning. The film introduces moviegoers to Bram Stoker's Count Dracula, played by Bela Lugosi. Edward Van Sloan, Dwight Frye, Helen Chandler, runs 85 minutes. Actor Bela Lugosi played Dracula on stage prior to taking on the iconic role for the Universal picture. However, Lugosi was not the studio's first choice. Universal wanted Lon Chaney to play the part, but the actor passed away of lung cancer in 1930. I think it would have been a significantly different performance. Obviously, a significantly different movie if Lon Chaney had played the role.
Well, you probably wouldn't have had that whole Hungarian style accent thing going on.
Well, I mean, Bela Lugosi played him really successfully on Broadway.
Yeah,
and it's a very theatrical performance. I mean, it's the Dracula that we all like were introduced to as a kid. With the voice and the "I never drink wine," that whole thing, "Children of the Night," that all of that stuff is just, you know, it's now, it's absolutely completely associated with Dracula.
Yeah, it's basically, but it's canon.
It's a really showy performance. It's a really, really showy performance. And yeah. An alternate version of Dracula was filmed during the nighttime hours on the same set at the same time with Spanish-speaking actors, and it is considered a vastly superior picture in terms of technical achievement. It is better. It's a better movie. The Spanish version is better. But yeah, so like the English version, like Todd Browning and his crew would leave, and then like 10:30 p.m., 11 p.m., the Spanish crew would come in and shoot on the same sets till about 6 in the morning.
What?
Oh, yeah. It was made at the same time, but the Spanish the Spanish crew had to use the sets between like midnight and 6 a.m.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's how they got the Spanish version.
Yeah. Have you seen the Spanish version?
I have not.
You got to see it, man.
I did not know its existence.
Oh, no, you got to see it. It's better than the Todd Browning movie.
Really?
It's better. I'm not kidding. It's better.
Like performances, everything. All the camera work, everything?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Dracula's lair, or the outside of the castle, was a painting on glass which was placed in front of the camera. But the coach carrying Renfield was real while the background was fake. By the way, best Renfield ever. Actor David Manners, who played Jonathan Harker, claimed to have never watched Dracula, which is extraordinary since he didn't die until December 23rd of 1998. Come on, man. Wow. Undoubtedly, Dracula was Bela Lugosi's most famous performance, and the character made appearances in numerous Universal Picture productions. However, Lugosi only played Dracula twice. In Dracula, and then he came back for Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Which is very strange, because he refused to do the other Dracula movies.
Yeah.
But then he came back for Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Well, you know, when Abbott and Costello come knocking.
Well, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein was at the tail end of the popularity of the Universal monster movies. It was sort of this, you know, last-ditch effort to get some box office out of the Universal monster movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, a massive hit, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, because the box office for the Universal monster movies had declined. And in some cases, the quality of the movies had declined as well. And with so many different actors and actresses switching roles and playing different monsters and stuff like that, it became kind of confusing. So when you get an all-star lineup in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and I love that movie. That's one of the most requested movies for Sven.
Is Abbott and Costello?
Yeah, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Actress Betty Davis was considered to play the part of Mina Harker, but the head of Universal Pictures didn't believe she was sexy enough. Okay. And then everybody knows this. At his funeral, Lugosi was dressed in one of Dracula's capes for his burial.
Really? I did not know.
Oh, he was buried in one of the Dracula capes that he wore.
Do you know if it was at his request?
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
It was. So the same year Dracula came out, Frankenstein came out. If you can kind of imagine the impact that these movies made, because there was nothing like them on screen before. Nobody had ever seen anything like Frankenstein or Frankenstein's monster on screen before. These things were terrifying. Like they terrified people. Like I said about the Phantom of the Opera, same thing holds true with Frankenstein.
I mean, Frankenstein, James Whale's Frankenstein still kind of gives me the willies.
It's great. I mean, I like Bride of Frankenstein more.
Yeah,
I think Bride of Frankenstein's a better film, but they're both fantastic. And yeah. and you know, Karloff's performance is great as the monster. I mean, great. And it's even better in Bride. So directed by James Whale, the film adaptation of, you've seen Gods and Monsters, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, I know you haven't seen Shadow of the Vampire. You had to have seen Gods and Monsters. Directed by James Whale, the film adaptation of Frankenstein drastically veers from the story presented in Mary Shelley's 1818 novelization. But Dr. Frankenstein, played by Colin Clive, still does the unthinkable and creates life in the form of a hideous monster played by Boris Karloff. Only runs 70 minutes, Frankenstein. So I'll give you more facts and trivia about Frankenstein when we get back from the break. I love the way that The Bride of Frankenstein opens. I love that it's Mary Shelley and Byron, and they're all talking about, you know, they're all talking about horror stories and stuff. I just love that that's how Bride of Frankenstein opens. It's just one, it's one of my favorites.
Although when I tried to watch it after I saw the Drunk History episode, I can't help but laugh because I knew the story because we read Frankenstein in high school, and they tell you about how Lord Byron's basically a complete maniac and all that kind of stuff.
Have you ever seen Gothic?
No.
Oh.
What's Gothic?
Ken Russell. It's about, you know, the weekend that they did the partying and taking the drugs, and it's about
Weekend at Byron's.
It's about Byron, and it's about Shelley, and it's insane. Gabriel Byrne is in it. I want to say Amanda Donahoe. It's called Gothic. It's Ken Russell. So that should tell you right there how insane. Is it Teresa? No, Teresa Russell's not in that one. No, but it's Ken Russell, and it was during his Vestron film, where he was working for Vestron Studios.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say it was like 86, maybe 87. And it's completely insane.
Yeah. You got Gabriel Byrne as Lord Byron, Julian Sands as Percy Shelley.
Right.
Natasha Richardson as Mary Wollstonecraft.
Right.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And that was right around the same time he did another insane movie called Lair of the White Worm, which I think came either the year before or the year after Gothic. And it was like this double, 2 years in a row where Ken Russell made these surrealistic, absolutely insane horror films. Lair of the White Worm is awesome. Gothic's just insane and crazy and fun to watch, but Lair of the White Worm is like really awesome. And Amanda Donahoe is in that. I'm getting them confused. But yeah, that was like Ken Russell doing a back-to-back, like low-budget, Vestron-produced horror, one based on a true story, and the other just nuts. So, all right. Hey, all right, let's take a break. We're talking about the essential golden age horror movies. 312-981-7200. More after this.
When me and my friends go out in the town, we can't sit still, we can't sit down. We don't like to fight and we don't like to scuffle. All night doing the curly shuffle. Hey Mo, hey Mo,
hey Mo, hey Mo.
Well, oh, who requested the curly shuffle?
It's coming to us from Steve.
Who's the band that did this?
Jump in the Saddle.
Jump in the Saddle Band.
Yeah, Jump in the Saddle Band.
Jump in the Saddle Band. Big hit. Yes. Played frequently by the one, the only Dr. Demento. So. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're celebrating horror because the Flashback Weekend Horror Convention starts on Friday. We talked with Sven Gulli earlier, and he's going to be there. And so is Sam Raimi, and so is Bruce Campbell, and Robert Englund, and Tony Todd Virginia Madsen, a full-on Night of the Creeps reunion. All of the lovely ladies from the Nightmare franchise are going to be there. There's going to be a costume contest. There's going to be photo opportunities, screenings of movies, Q&As, many of which I will be monitoring, and a wonderful tribute to 40 years of Svengoolie that I am hosting. Rich and I will be on stage. It starts Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Flashback Convention, which is at the Crown Plaza Hotel. So you should probably come on out to that. Hey, by the way, coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We are talking about the essential Golden Age horror movies. We were just talking about Frankenstein, which came out the same year as Dracula, 1931. Following the success of Universal's Dracula, which opened earlier that same year, the studio wanted their new star, Bela Lugosi, to play the part of the monster, but Lugosi turned down the role because the creature didn't have any dialogue in the movie. 44-year-old Boris Karloff was a virtual unknown when director James Whale spotted him in Universal's commissary, and that chance encounter ended up changing the course of Karloff's life. Karloff went from unknown to uncanny. In the final credits or the cast list with characters and cast list, it says the monster is played by ? That's how they bill it. Like, oh, it's a real monster. It's not. And then he was billed as just Karloff. In both the first two Frankenstein movies, just as Karloff. In fact, even after the production, Karloff was such an unknown actor that he wasn't invited to the premiere of Frankenstein. Wow.
That's just rude. That's just mean.
His name doesn't even appear in the opening credits, as we were just talking about. I did not know that he wasn't invited to the premiere. That's just crazy.
Can't believe that.
The monster's shoes, which is a mainstay in the iconic costume, weighed 13 pounds each. Took special effects artist Jack Pierce 4 hours to make up Karloff and Boris's costume, weighed a total of 48 pounds. Wow. 13 pounds each on his feet and 48-pound costume and 4 hours of makeup. That sounds fun. Frankenstein was banned in Kansas because its content was that of cruelty and tended to debase morals. Kansas didn't like the movie.
No.
Boris Karloff played the monster 3 times in the Universal Pictures. After Frankenstein, he returned for Bride of Frankenstein and then Son of Frankenstein in 1935.
Now, I'm interested. They didn't mention, wasn't there a version where they took out the scene with him and, or they edited the scene with him and the little girl?
Oh, yeah. It was banned for a long time.
Yeah.
It was banned for a long time.
I'm trying to remember. Do you remember when they put it back in?
A few years after I think probably many years after.
For some reason, I keep thinking like somewhere in the 80s. Like they finally,
I think it was before
maybe
that.
A little bit before that.
Yeah,
but
I think it was before that. But it took a very, very long time for them to restore that scene.
It's like my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah, he just throws her in.
Yeah.
In the water. But I mean, not because she's throwing flowers into the water. And
yeah.
So he's like, oh, ha, 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 ha. He doesn't know any better. I mean, that's another thing about both of those movies, about Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. Clearly the victim is the monster.
Exactly. It's so
tragic.
And that's
what the movie's about. It's totally tragic.
I love it.
Here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Nick. Good morning. Great topic. I grew up as a kid like with creature features.
Yeah.
And it was the foundation for my knowledge of horror, and all those monsters are great. But there was one movie that they failed to ever show on Creature Features that I always looked forward to seeing, because the icon of Creature Features in WGN was Lon Chaney.
Yeah.
In London After Midnight, right?
Yeah.
And there's a mystique to that movie. It was. I don't think it was ever broadcast. Was it lost or something?
Yeah, it was totally lost. You can't find it.
There's
no full version of London After Midnight that you can see.
And it's like a fantastic makeup and creepy as hell.
Yeah, and that is,
it's
of course, that is the image that's forever associated with Channel 9's Creature Features.
Yeah, and it's like just ironic that it was never shown. You know?
Well, yeah, you can't get it. That's the problem. I mean, there are scenes of it that are available, but you cannot get a full copy. One of those lost movies. I'm not sure what the whole story is behind it, but it's one of those movies that got lost, and so you can't. It's one of those tragic things where that's a movie that we're never ever going to get to see. So
can I throw one other one?
All right.
Yeah, not seeing all that much, but it definitely had a mystique to it too. Was the original Cat People?
Cat People is a great film.
Yeah,
that's from the early days of the Val Lewton films, Val Lewton films, which were just beautiful and moody and wonderful. And then Paul Schrader made a ridiculous movie in the 80s called Cat People.
Yeah.
All right, Rich, thank you.
You bet. Right.
Yeah, and let me just say this: I actually like the Paul Schrader version of Cat People. For an entirely different reason than the original, because the original is just a magnificent movie. And but I kind of like Schrader's version because it's just so nuts, and it's got the David Bowie song in it. So
I like the Leopard Man.
Yeah,
where you don't actually see the Leopard Man.
Yeah, there's a bunch of movies like that. There's a bunch of movies in the early days where they would name a movie after a monster or a creature, and then you don't see it. All right, let's break. We've got more of the essential golden age of horror to talk about, and then we are also going to talk about some of the most terrifying, scary CGI monsters in movies. We're talking horror flashback this weekend. It's going to be a blast.
Now I'm of consenting age to be forgetting you in a cabaret somewhere downtown where a burlesque queen may even ask my name.
All right. Who was that, and who requested that?
412 wanted to hear a little Panic at the Disco.
Oh, that's who that was?
Yep.
Okay. I know the name. I don't know the music. All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Hey, coming up after the 4:30 news, another edition of Know Your Onion. This is when Tom is your host, and we'll have two different contestants call in, two listeners. They'll each play their own round, and the idea is Tom will read some news headlines, and you have to decide whether they are real or from The Onion, The Onion being the funny, fake, satirical newspaper. The deal with the game is that real news right now is so weird that sometimes you can't tell the difference between real news and The Onion. So that's coming up. Know Your Onion. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Having some fun leading up to Flashback Weekend, which is a horror convention that I've been a part of since 2002. Lots of great stuff and incredible guests are going to be there, including Svengoolie, celebrating 40 years of Svengoolie. And I'm thrilled to be moderating that part of the evening on Friday, starting at 7. It's at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Rosemont, and you can check out flashbackweekend.com for tickets and a full schedule. It's loaded with great guests, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So we're celebrating some horror stuff right now and going through some of the Golden Age classics that you should all watch. 815 area code sends in a text. You can send in a text or call us right now at 312-981-7200. It says Hunchback of Notre Dame, a classic that's unmatched. It is brilliant. It is brilliant.
Way better than the Disney movie.
Yeah. 815 area code says, Bela Lugosi was supposed to play the vampire in Plan 9 from Outer Space, but died before filming. That's not true. He's in it. Bela Lugosi is in Plan 9 from Outer Space. He died while filming, not before filming. And he was replaced by the doctor of director Ed Wood's wife, who is significantly taller than Bela Lugosi. So Ed Wood had him cover his face with the cape. But Bela Lugosi's in it. There's actual footage of Bela Lugosi. Well, I mean, if anybody's seen the Tim Burton movie, Martin Landau won a supporting actor award for playing Bela Lugosi in that. I think that's Tim Burton's best movie. I think Ed Wood is Tim Burton's best movie.
And I'm not really a fan of Tim Burton in most respects, but yeah. I really love Ed Wood.
And see, I'm one of those guys that I'm with Tim Burton all the way through.
I don't know how. Sometimes, though.
I mean, I'm trying to think if I Well, this is the one that everybody thinks I'm nuts. I think Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is better than Willy Wonka. It's more faithful. It's much more faithful to the book. And it doesn't have terrible songs in it, because Willy Wonka has terrible songs in it. The Candyman is one of the worst songs of all time.
You don't like Pure Imagination?
No.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Brings a tear to the eye.
I don't like it. I think Gene Wilder's great, and I like the movie because I grew up on that one. But sure. I eventually read the Roald Dahl story, and Tim Burton's is much more faithful.
I wish I could have beaten Johnny Depp with a stick.
I thought he was great.
Oh my God!
I thought he was great. I thought that I really do. And one of my favorite of the whole like ladder Tim Burton, Johnny Depp creations is Sweeney Todd. I think Sweeney Todd is amazing.
Sweeney Todd's pretty cool.
I love Sweeney Todd.
I'm not super into musicals, so that's one of the reasons.
Well,
but I do appreciate the amount of like fun they had clearly designing everything. I admit that Tim Burton's got an eye for production design. He knows exactly how to make something very unique.
His worst movie is his last movie, is Dumbo. That's the worst movie he's ever made. It's even worse than Planet of the Apes
or Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland is pretty bad. The sequel's even worse. He didn't even direct the sequel. The sequel is unbelievable. Yeah.
Maybe it's him working with Disney. Outside of maybe, I never got into The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Well, he didn't direct that.
No, that's true.
Henry Selick directed that. A lot of people, everybody gets that wrong. Henry Selick directed that movie. But I don't love it either. I think it's kind of cool. I don't love it as much. I dated a girl who was, when that movie came out, I was dating this girl. She was way into it.
It's freaky though.
She lost her mind and was like way into it. I'll tell you another animated one that I love. I love The Corpse Bride. I think The Corpse Bride.
I took a girl on a date to go see The Corpse Bride.
That's a great movie
because she was into The Nightmare on Elm Street.
Well, Nightmare Before Christmas. Yeah. Frank and Weenie, awesome.
These freaky Hot Topic girls. I know what's going on, man.
Yeah. No, I'm a fan of Tim Burton. I mean, he's, you know, I just think he's like in Mars Attacks, I think is awesome. Beetlejuice is awesome.
I forgot about Mars Attacks.
Mars Attacks
is
great.
I do love Mars Attacks.
Yeah. Beetlejuice, Pee Wee's Big Adventure. Big Fish is phenomenal.
Well, I put that all on the shoulders of Albert Finney.
He just
drives it home.
So, all right, here's the next Golden Age classic that you had to have seen, and that would be The Mummy. Directed by Karl Freund, the evil mummy Imhotep, played by Boris Karloff, rises from his own death and begins the process of resurrecting his princess. I'll tell you something. I love that movie. It's a very slow-moving movie. If you watch The Mummy, not a whole lot happens in it. But there is a scene in the movie where, as a little kid, you know, one of the first times I watched it, I completely freaked out because there's a scene in the movie where the mummy actually rises from its tomb and leaves, and the dude who witnesses it goes so nuts that he can't stop laughing, like maniacally, insanely, way scarily laughing. And I remember as a kid, that scared the hell out of me. That scene where the dude cannot stop laughing maniacally, I was terrified as a kid. Here's what they say. A year earlier, during the filming of Frankenstein, Karloff was an unknown commodity for Universal. He was promoted heavily as the uncanny. It is astonishing what a year's difference can make. The word pharaoh must not have been used back in 1932 because in both the opening and closing credits, they have misspelled it. Imhotep, of course, was based in name only on the ancient Egyptian architect who designed the pyramids. Unlike the Imhotep featured in the film, the real man was represented as a god following his death. Actress Zita Johann and director Karl Freund hated each other. The set was full of tension, especially when the director insisted that Johann play the princess partially nude. He made my life very unpleasant, she said in an interview. It was his first picture as a director, and if he needed a scapegoat in case he didn't come in on schedule, 23 days, I believe. So I was cast as the scapegoat. The director took his feud with Zeta much further by refusing to get her a chair with her name on it. Even more shocking was that he left her unprotected in the pit of lions while he and the crew were safely locked away in protective cages. Good Lord! Finally, to keep her uncomfortable, the director had Zeta stand against a board on a wall for hours to keep wrinkles out of her costume dress. Wow, what a jerk.
Yeah. At least the movie was good.
Yeah, it's very good. It took makeup artist Jack Pierce 8 hours to apply Boris Karloff's mummy appliances. The costume's appearance was based on Ramses III. After the makeup was applied the first time, Karloff was quoted as saying to Jack Pierce, "Well, you've done a wonderful job, but you forgot to give me a fly." The mummy holds the record for the most money paid for a movie poster at auction. $453,500 for a movie poster.
Woo!
So, okay. And the final, most essential, Golden Age horror film, King Kong, from 1933. And, you know, I showed King Kong at my film club a few years back on the big screen, as I mentioned before. And that holds up today. Movie was released in 1933. That movie holds up today as well as any big action adventure movie could. Marion C. Cooper and Ernest B. Schoedsack directed the giant ape King Kong is discovered on the mysterious Skull Island by ambitious director Carl Denham. But Kong's love for the young ingenue Ann Darrow, played by Fay Wray, leads to a deadly confrontation atop the Empire State Building. So, you know, when Peter Jackson did his version of it in 2005, which I adore.
Agreed. I really like
it. It's great. Jack Black was a nervous wreck because he had to say it was Beauty that killed the Beast. And that's like one of the classic lines of all time. And he was like a nervous wreck when he had to say
it. I would be too.
Yeah.
He's stepping into a lot.
One of the most iconic lines in movie history. All right, here's some trivia about King Kong. Kong's famous howl was the combination of both a lion and tiger roaring at the same time. However, the sound effect was played backwards and more slowly to achieve Kong's unique noise. The King of Skull Island does not appear in the film until 47 minutes in. That's true. It takes a long time. Also takes a long time for Kong to appear in Peter Jackson's. Well, Peter Jackson's movie is like almost 2 hours longer, an hour and a half longer than King Kong. King Kong grossed $90,000 on its opening weekend back in 1933, which was the largest film debut at the time. The film's success saved RKO Studio from bankruptcy. Kong was actually several 18 to 22-inch models made from metal skeleton, rubber, and foam with rabbit fur for his hairy exterior. A small 22-inch but essential prop for the film was sold for $203,000 at an auction in 2009. If you went to see the original 1933 release of King Kong, it would have cost you 35 cents.
Jeez.
Well, it was only 75 cents for Sharon Tate to see The Wrecking Crew.
That's true.
Well, she got in for free. She said 75 cents.
Yeah.
The original Laserdisc edition of King Kong contained the first audio commentary accompaniment to any motion picture ever. Wow, I didn't know that.
That is super cool.
Because it was the Laserdisc that started that.
Yeah. Well, because the Criterion Collection started on that.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Actress Jean Harlow was offered the role of Anne but refused to play the part. Frances Lee was also considered, but she lost out to Fay Wray. King Kong was the feature film debut of actor Bill Williams, Deadline at Dawn, Rio Lobo, The Adventures of Kit Carson, but his name does not appear in the credits. Williams portrayed one of the New York City theatergoers. And then it's often argued that King Kong is more of an adventure flick than a horror movie. Clearly, with today's subgenres, Kong falls into the giant monster movie. Still can't believe it's a horror movie? Take this into consideration. The body count in the 1933 version of King Kong comes to 40 deaths.
Jeez.
Yeah.
You know what that original version is missing? That whole bug pit thing.
Yeah.
From the Peter Jackson. That really freaked me out.
Well, everything on Skull Island was nuts. Like everything would be alive. They're hiding, and all of a sudden a log comes to life. You know, yeah. What I mean? It was just...
Yeah, but Andy Serkis getting devoured by giant leeches.
Yeah.
That really, that hit me hard in 2005.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I really love that movie. I really did. And I cried at the end. I thought it was beautiful. Where he's got Naomi Watts and they're just kind of sliding around on the ice in Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. It's very romantic.
It was very good.
Yeah. All right. So those are some classics right there. Those are the go-to for your golden era. But now we're going to move up to CGI. The 13 scariest CGI monsters in movies. So, yeah. So maybe. The bugs in King Kong should be considered for this.
I really think so.
All right. Okay, we're going to take a break. What are some of the creatures that were created recently in movies that really freaked you out, that were really scary, that were CGI and unbelievable? 312-981-7200 for talk and text.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha.
Ah, yes. Ah, yes. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. What is it, Napoleon? What is this? Bonaparte the 20th or something?
Let me do my Roman numerals here. That is 14th. Napoleon 14.
Napoleon 14. And that is, they're coming to take me away, haha.
Yes.
Who requested that?
Margaret in Bridgeport. Was that played on Dr. Demento?
A lot.
Yeah, that's what she was saying.
Yeah. He had this thing on every show, at the end of the show, they would do the Funny Five. And it would be the five most requested songs of the week. And that was how the show ended, would be with the Funny Five. And he would play the five most requested songs. And inevitably, that was on there many times on the Funny Five. All right. So we go from the golden era of horror, the classics, the old school ones, silent ones, the universal ones, the ones that you have to see in order to be a completist when it comes to horror. And now we're going to go to some scary monsters. We were just talking about King Kong. And the Peter Jackson remake of King Kong was all the creatures were obviously done with CGI and things like that. So that's what we're talking about. The 13 scariest CGI monsters in movies. 312-981-7200. Here it says, let's be honest here. Everybody loves a good old-fashioned practical effects monster like John Carpenter's The Thing. Feature effects so detailed, so tactile, so gooey and strange that they look infinitely more real than their expensive CGI reboots. Yeah, Rob Bottin's effects in The Thing are insane.
And it's hard for me to believe. You watch the documentaries and everything. He was literally younger than me now. He was 23, yeah. 24.
Yeah. He was a Rick Baker protege.
Yeah.
And the effects in The Thing are completely crazy.
Bar none.
And the best of any practical effects in movies. Ever. And back in 1982, it was insanely groundbreaking. He had worked on The Howling. He did the effects on Dante's The Howling, which were great. And then he would eventually go on to do other insanely great makeup work, like Tim Curry's Devil in Legend, which is one of the greatest makeup achievements ever. And even cheesier films like the majority of the original Godzilla flicks have a homemade quality that makes them arguably more inviting than their big-budget Hollywood counterparts. But CGI technology has evolved over the years. The remake of The Lion King is pushing photorealism to new heights, even if it's not doing the actual story any favors. And the trailer for Tom Hooper's Cats is frankly the scariest thing on the internet in a long time. There are, by now, quite a lot of damn good, very scary CGI monsters in movies. So although we'll always have a special place in our hearts for the practical effects, it's time to give credit where credit is due and hail the following films for scaring the crap out of us with a series of ones and zeros. Note, we are focusing on films that feature scary monsters, biological in origin. Monsters are eligible whether or not the films are firmly in the horror genre, although many of these monsters are created using a combination of practical and CG effects. We are only highlighting the creatures which use a significant amount of CG throughout their presence on screen. So these are scary CGI monsters. That's what we're talking about. And if you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. First up, Annihilation. Oh, man. My parents did not get that movie at all. They were like, what do we want? What the hell is this? Especially during the last 15 minutes. Last 15 minutes of that movie.
That's a tough 15 minutes to explain to anybody,
yeah.
Really.
What? I love the movie, though.
Yeah, it's an incredible achievement.
Yeah. Alex Garland's acclaimed sci-fi horror thriller about a team of scientists who venture into an extraterrestrial singularity where evolution has gone haywire is chock full of nightmare imagery. Picking only one monster is a fool's errand. The doppelganger at the end of the film is an eerie creation. Yeah, that whole last part of the movie was insane. Unlike just anything else we've seen, and the bear with the skull face that screams like a person is an absolute terror. That's the scene. That's the scene in the movie that's like, what am I watching?
I started tearing up actually out of fright because the screaming.
The scream was just ridiculous. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And the movie made no money, but people should see it. It's great. Mm-hmm. Alex Garland, you know, Ex Machina, he also directed that, which is a great film.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when they cut the dude open and intestines are like moving around, the monster's like running.
It's like writhing in his.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. Well, they were smart because they knew Alex Garland and Paramount, they knew it was going to make no money.
Yeah.
So they sold the international streaming rights to Netflix and made the entire budget back.
Yeah. Well, that was a smart move. Great cast, too.
Incredible cast.
All the way around. But yeah, those creatures are scary, and that bear skull thing, whatever the hell that was, it screamed like a person. Forget it, man. Completely freaked me out. All right. Okay, we're going to take a break here, and we got the news coming up after this, and then we're going to get back into some really, really scary CGI monsters that we see in movies today. 312-981-7200. We're talking horror stuff in honor of Flashback, which is coming up on Friday. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6. Wildcard Wednesday. You mean Wildcard Wednesday here? Okay, who requested that?
That's coming to us from Thomas. The Space Ghost theme Space from 66.
Ghost. Ah, yes. The original Space Ghost. Not Space Ghost Coast to Coast.
Possibly my favorite television show of all time.
It was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Well, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. And, we are celebrating some horror stuff because this weekend is big for horror. If you're a horror fan, you know where you need to be. You need to be at the Crowne Plaza Hotel for the Flashback Weekend Convention with tons of really great horror stars and lots of fun activities and screenings and an unbelievable merchandise merch room, which has got incredible vendors where you're going to spend a lot. I'm going to spend a lot of money this weekend.
Oh my God.
So it's going to be, it's always a blast. It's always my favorite weekend of the year. I am going to be hosting a lot of Q&As and introducing a lot of people. I will be moderating the fantastic Svengoolie 40th anniversary celebration with me and Rich Coase on stage. We'll be showing videos and hanging out. And it's going to be a blast. So get to flashbackweekend.com right now. You can get your tickets, make your reservations, and check out the full schedule of all the incredible events and photo opportunities and great things that will be happening all weekend long. A 1 3-day celebration of all things horror. So we've been talking about some scary stuff. We went back to the golden era of horror movies. A little bit at the beginning of the show, we talked to our good friend Rich Coves about him being Svengoolie. And now we're jumping into the world of CGI with the scariest CGI monsters in movies today. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We got some texts coming in here. 847 area code says, The Abyss. That was groundbreaking stuff. That was a couple of years before T2. And so it wasn't quite as mastered as T2 was. But that whole liquid, you know, human forming into a liquid, that kind of thing, that began in The Abyss. The effects were better in T2, but still... Yeah.
Was that still Industrial Light and Magic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, The Abyss is a good movie. I like that movie. 217 area code says Jar Jar Binks, the stuff of nightmares.
I feel so bad because that just ruined that dude's life.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
the guy who had to be the stand-in.
Not just that guy, but the kid who played Anakin. What the hell was his name? Jake Lloyd. I think his name was Jake Lloyd.
Yeah, that's it.
Um, 815 area code says the Demogorgon in Stranger Things is pretty badass. Yeah, it's a pretty good creature. Yeah, pretty good creature. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about these scary, really scary CGI creations. Next year, after we talk about... Annihilation is Beowulf. Nice to see that on here. From 2007, Robert Zemeckis spent years trying to perfect motion capture animation technology, and the results were decidedly mixed. One of the better films he directed in the medium was Beowulf, which was a mature fantasy epic based on the classic tale and features one of the scariest CG creatures around, Grendel, played by Crispin Glover, and brought to mutated and grotesque life by the animation team. Is a tragic but violent creature who wants his neighbors to shut up and will absolutely destroy them to get some peace and quiet. Great creation. Great voice work by Crispin Glover.
I got to give him that.
And the fact that they settled their dispute and actually worked together was a huge thing.
I forget, what was the upset? Because I know it's not Crispin Glover in Back to the Future Part 2.
Well, that's the upset.
Is that they didn't bring him back?
No, he didn't want to do it, and they hired a guy and made him look exactly like Crispin Glover.
Okay.
They hung him upside down, but they made him exactly look and talk like Crispin Glover, and he sued and won. And so for a while, he and Zemeckis were on the outs.
As one might imagine.
And then they made up, and he's fantastic. His voice work in Beowulf is fantastic. And that creature is really, really creepy. But I've interviewed Crispin Glover a few times. An incredibly nice guy. Like a really, really... He's weird.
Sure.
You know, but like really nice. My ex-wife, Heather, was in love with him. In love with him. Had his books, his artwork... The whole thing. Saw his weirdo movies at the Music Box that he made.
What movies were those?
Oh, as you don't know what he's directed like three insane movies.
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh man, what is it? I can't remember the name of him. I guess you could just wake up my ex-wife now and call her up and say what, because it was Everything Is Fine.
It is fine. Everything is fine.
Right. There's that one. And that one, if I'm not mistaken, is populated entirely by people with Down syndrome.
That's what is it?
What is it? That's what is it? Yeah. So he directed those movies, and they screened him at the Music Box, and he showed up, signed his books and stuff, and my ex Heather went to see both of them, and she loved him. So I had him on the show. He also. This was really one of my favorite things that I have ever seen at the Music Box. It was a Guy Madden movie. It was a silent movie. And black and white silent film. I can't remember the name of it. Crispin Glover was there. It's another thing that I took my ex-wife to. This was at the Music Box. He was the narrator. So he was on stage doing the voiceover narration for the movie very dramatically and very Crispin Glovery. So he was on stage, but what was amazing was that there was a live, band, which if I remember correctly, consisted of maybe just a little bit more than a string quartet. And there were a group of Foley artists on stage that were providing the sound effects for the movie, like breaking glass and walking on cement and, doing these things that Foley artists, like radio, you know, like radio Foley artists would do. And it was amazing. It was completely amazing to watch. Like, you know, you watch the movie, you're looking at the movie, and then you want to watch the Foley artists do their thing. And I can't remember the name of the damn movie, but it was probably about 12, 13 years ago. And Guy Madden directed it. And as you can, if you know who Guy Madden is, you know it's probably a weird movie. But I thought it was really cool. And he did a great job narrating. Very dramatic and way over the top. But like watching the band and the Foley artists do their thing and what they were doing to provide the sounds that were in the movie was amazing. But yeah, Crispin Glover, nice guy. Nice guy. I asked him about the Zemeckis thing, and he says, "No, we're okay now. We're fine." And this was like, it's got to be right around the same, because Beowulf came out in 2007. So the last time I interviewed him, I believe, was around that time. And that, I think, was the time that he was doing the silent film, the Guy Madden film, that he was in town to do that. He was not really forthcoming, a little bit coy, because I asked him about the David Letterman appearance, the classic David Letterman appearance.
Yeah, that I didn't know about.
And when what was the deal there? And it seemed clear to me that it was like this weird sort of piece of performance art, not unlike what Joaquin Phoenix attempted to do.
Yeah, it was kind of like a Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, it's exactly
thing. Yeah.
The Joaquin Phoenix appearance. I remember the first time I saw the Joaquin Phoenix appearance on Letterman, I thought it was hilarious. And then I realized that it was all an act for that awful, unwatchable movie that he and Casey Affleck made. I despise that movie. That's one of those movies where at the end I was roaringly angry. I mean, I was like unbelievably angry at the end of that movie, and it was like 2 hours and 15 minutes long.
Yeah, it was really not.
And it was like, oh, I'm not going to act anymore, and I'm going to rap, and we'll make this fake documentary. I'm Still Here, I think it's called.
I always confuse it with the Bob Dylan movie.
Yeah.
The one where like Kate Blanchett
Is it Todd Solondz?
It's not.
Why am I blanking on? It's somebody like Todd Solondz, somebody on the same sort of tier as Todd Solondz.
I'm Not There by Todd Haynes.
Todd Haynes. Haynes.
So then,
what's the other one called? Because the other one is like I'm Not Here.
It's I'm Still Here.
I'm Still Here.
All right. So that's always confuse those two.
Yeah, they're very similar titles.
Because one is amazing and the incredible, the other is complete crap.
Yeah, that's funny because I saw two movies in one day that inspired lots of walkouts. One of them was the Dylan movie.
They walked out of that movie?
Lots of people walked
Why?
Out of that movie. Lots of people walked out. And there was another movie that I saw that same day. I saw two movies that day. Both of them had multiple walkouts. One of them was the Dylan movie, and I can't remember what the other one was. But people walked out of both of the films I saw that day.
I can't believe people would walk out of I'm
Not
There.
A lot of people walked out.
That is shocking.
Yeah. All right. Why don't we take a break here for some weather, and then we'll come back and talk about more of these crazy, scary CGI monsters. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Wildcard Wednesday. You've been well, one artist, any song, any artist, anything. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from Mr. B, a little 10cc.
10cc, all right. Okay. Well, yeah, we're here till 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. All right, we've been talking about some of the scariest CGI monsters in movies. Next, according to Bloody Disgusting, they already put cats down. They already put cats down on the list of scariest CGI monsters. Here's what they say. Look, we haven't seen Tom Hooper's Cats yet, but the trailer is one of the most off-putting previews we've seen in years. Famous actors covered in only 50% convincing CG transformed into weird cat monsters with physiology that makes no sense and a scale that makes them look even tinier than real cats. If you saw these things running around your house, you would lose your damn mind and no one would blame you. Yeah. Have you seen the video that's all over the internet where they intercut the scene? Have you seen Hardcore with George C. Scott, the Paul Schrader movie?
Yes. I think
he's looking for his daughter, and she went into the porn business, and that's...
Is that when he goes into the theater?
He goes into the porno theater. So they intercut his reactions to watching his daughter in a porn movie in a sleazy porno theater, but he's actually watching the Cats trailer. That's... And the whole where he's like, turn it off!
Yeah.
That's all. They're intercutting it with the Cats trailer. It's really funny. It's really, really funny. Yeah.
I don't get Tom Hooper's obsession with getting into this realm of, because he did Les Mis.
Yes, he did.
And it was not very good.
I thought it sucked. It took me 3 sessions to get through it. I had a screener of it.
Yeah.
I got a screener of it and I was like, all right. Because I like the musical. I saw it on Broadway. I saw it here in Chicago at the Auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a good musical. I like it.
Yeah.
But man, the movie was unbelievable. It was horrendous. And God, Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Man, Hugh Jackman can sing. Anne Hathaway can sing. But it's really poorly directed.
Yeah.
And his decision to have them sing live on set as opposed to, like, maybe, you know, dub it in later, in theory is a nice idea. Mm-hmm. Did not work, especially in the case of Russell Crowe.
No.
But, you know, it's a terrible movie, and I had to turn it off. I was like, okay.
Yeah, and I'm not a Les Mis musical fan. I mean, I recognize the importance of it. I get that it's one of the most beloved of all time. Maybe it was because so many theater kids just never shut up about it.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that. I just think I think, when Les Mis, like, really took off and became as popular as it was at the height of the popularity of a guy who you and I both think is a hack, and that's, speaking of cats, is Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yeah.
Cameron McIntosh is a lot different than, you know, and
that
the,
is true.
And the guys who wrote the music, the people who wrote the music for Les Mis, they actually wrote good music and, like, songs.
Well,
that
yeah,
were,
I mean, I can, even I
it,
can't
even it tells
deny
the story that's, it's, it tells a story that really is, you
yeah,
know.
It's more of an opera, really. I mean, because they never really stop singing.
Yeah. And, so. And also, it inspired one of my favorite Key and Peele sketches of all time when they do the Les Mis.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So brilliant. But yeah, Tom Hooper, what the hell else did he direct? He directed...
he did The King's Speech, which is immensely overrated.
Yeah, yes. I think that's about all I can remember that he did.
He did a lot. He did John Adams for HBO. He did...
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, he's done good stuff. There's things he's been a part of that I thought were really good. It's just this weird turn to... He did. My favorite thing he's ever done was a soccer movie called The Damned United.
Oh, yeah. That's a great movie.
With Michael Sheen.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. He directed that?
Yeah.
What?
I know.
All right. How about more CGI scares? Everything in Harry Potter. They say from 2001 to the present. Harry Potter movies have featured a lot of CGI creatures, including giant spiders and centaurs and dragons and cat leviathans. And some may have been more convincing than others, but although your mileage might vary across the whole series, certainly the Dementors are iconically creepy creations. These floating Reaper monsters, which violently suck away your capacity to feel anything but misery, are one of the biggest big bads of the whole franchise. And every time they show up, it's a spooky thrill. I agree with that. I totally
agree
with that. Freaky.
Very freaky.
Yeah. Yeah, the Dementors. Oh, how about this? The Host. God, did that come out in 2006? Has it really been that long?
Yeah, I remember watching it when it finally broadcast on American television.
Wow. We're not sure how exactly dumping formaldehyde into a river led to a giant fish monster, but that's science for you. Anyway, Bong Joon-ho's The Host tells the story of such a creature about the size of a van which terrorizes Korea and looks damn scary doing it, although not most of the... Not the most convincing CGI ever. The director has confidence in the creature and lets the audience get a nice long look at it in the daylight, which makes existence all the more surreal. Yeah, that's a good movie. I wasn't crazy about the one he did for Netflix.
Okja?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm excited to see Parasite, which he just won, the Palme d'Or for.
Yeah. I like his movies. I just didn't like the one that what the hell was Jake Gyllenhaal doing in that movie? What was going on there?
It wasn't my cup of tea.
Jurassic Park, dating back from 1993 to the present. It's easy to overlook the fact that although the Jurassic Park movies are mega blockbusters for the whole family, they're also obviously monster movies. Mad scientists on a remote island play God, create man-eating monstrosities, which, what a shock, run amok and eat men. The special effects in the original film, which also incorporated some practical effects, are still extraordinarily convincing, and the sequels have always tried to top the original with more killer dinos to make the audience shriek. Yeah, I remember seeing Jurassic Park at a screening in 1993, before it was released, and being very impressed by the special effects. Jurassic Park was a real groundbreaker in terms of the combination of practical, but really one of the first, I mean, this is back in 1993, one of the first movies to really do the computer thing really convincingly. Like, the effects were really great in the original Jurassic Park, as they are in all the Jurassic Park movies. But the original, I remember that being a groundbreaker. I didn't like the movie. I don't like Jurassic Park, but I just remember going, wow, you know what I mean? This is really the cutting edge of special effects technology, and it looks fantastic. I just wish they had written a script. But all of the Jurassic Park movies have some pretty great special effects moments in them. And I'm not gonna not say that the T-Rex scene is not great, because it is. And the guy on the toilet, I love that, but I just don't like the movie. So, like I've said before, and I know you walked out of the one that I think is the best. I thought the last one was the best of the series. I thought the last, what the hell was it called? Jurassic World?
Fallen Kingdom?
Yeah.
There something. You go. Oh my God.
That's, I think, the best of the series.
I'll grant you that the bit in the final act that takes place mostly in the house, in the big mansion,
yeah,
is very, very cool. If only that would have been like most of the movie. You've got an entire 2/3 of that movie that is cripplingly boring. And then the whole reveal with the little girl just basically didn't even need to happen.
Yeah.
You could have cut that out. If they had done the entire thing like that gothic horror section, we would be having a very different conversation.
Yeah. All right. I just was never into any of them, though. They would just,
that's
they
fair.
Were not, they
At
were not my, they're not my cup of tea. The first one I was like, eh, whatever. Took 45 minutes for a dinosaur to show up in that movie. All right. Let's break. The news is up after this. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio on a Wednesday morning, Wild Card Wednesday. You may welcome Wednesday. 312-981-7200 for talk and text and your wild card request. Who requested that?
That was Greg. Want to hear a little ELO?
There you go. You got to see them this past weekend.
Spectacular.
Awesome. Hey, welcome back, everybody. We've been talking about scary stuff. We're going to talk a little more scary stuff tomorrow because it's flashback weekend. I'm off Friday morning. I'm also off Monday morning because I will be at the hotel Friday through Sunday evening, running around like a maniac and doing a bunch of Q&As and introducing things and hanging out and, you know, taking pictures with celebrities and buying and spending money on horror stuff. It is the Flashback Weekend Horror Convention this weekend, and it's one of my favorite. It's my favorite weekend of the year. There's no question about it. And it's going to be a blast. Incredible guests, including Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell, Ted Raimi, Robert Englund, a bunch of the ladies from the Nightmare movies, Tom Atkins and the rest of the cast of Night of the Creeps for a big reunion, Tony Todd and Virginia Madsen from Candyman, big reunion there. There are screenings. There's a costume contest. There is a vendor room filled with incredible merchandise that I'm going to spend a lot of money on. You can get your pictures taken with celebrities professionally. You can get autographs. And it is a great, wonderful horror convention. And so in honor of the horror convention this weekend, and of course, we talked to Svengoolie earlier this morning, celebrating his 40th year playing Svengoolie, good old Rich Coase. He's going to be there. And I am so thrilled and honored to be hosting 40 years of Svengoolie with Rich on stage with me, and I will be moderating it. We'll play some clips and talk about his career as Svengoolie. It's going to be a great weekend. All of your schedules and details, everything you need, tickets, connections, all of that stuff, go to flashbackweekend.com, flashbackweekend.com. Make sure you come up and say hi, too. Find me. I'll be around the whole weekend. So there you go. In honor of that, we've been talking about some scary stuff. And right now we're talking about the scariest CGI monsters in movies. And we got some texts that have come in. Jesse says, Harry Potter had some scary characters, especially when I was younger. And then the movie I Am Legend is pretty freaky, too. I Am Legend has some CGI that's great and some that's not. There are some moments in I Am Legend where the effects are really cool, and then somewhere they're like, man... But I back that movie. It's one of the few Will Smith movies I like. Peter in Salt Village said, I hope that you've covered the aliens from the same named movies. Well, a lot of those are practical. There's some, you know, computer stuff that's used in them. But like Alien, that's practical. The original, and so is Aliens, I think.
Yeah, Aliens is entirely practical.
So yeah.
But you know, some of the later stuff
where they incorporate the CG to it. 815 area code said the CGI monster from the movie Mama was pretty creepy. I love that movie. And I think Jessica Chastain is fantastic in that movie.
I don't think I ever got the chance to see it.
Oh, it's really good. And Jessica Chastain, I like Jessica Chastain. She's all goth in that movie. Yeah.
You know what?
It's a really creepy movie.
It's Muschietti.
Yeah.
Andy Muschietti.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that explains.
It's a really creepy movie.
I'll check it out.
And she, I like that look for her. I know that was just for the movie because she plays like a kind of a, she's had some trouble. She's a mother, but she's also a rocker.
Yeah.
But she's wearing like the dark eyeliner. She's got black hair. Doesn't look anything like you would normally, you know, Jessica Chastain, clearly redhead.
Sure, yeah.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Porcelain, sort of pale skin. She had tattoos like in this movie. I was enjoying that look very much.
And also Nicolaj Coster-Waldau from the old Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I'll check it out.
It's a creepy movie. It's really, really creepy. I liked it a lot. So good CGI creature in that one, too. All right, now we're getting back to the scariest CGI monsters in movies, and this was written at bloodydisgusting.com. And they include Lord of the Rings, 2001 to 2003. J.R.R. Tolkien's dream of a beautiful Middle Earth was always undercut, at least by a little, by how many terrifying monsters were in it. Orcs, trolls, dragons, wraiths, you name it. Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings movies had it, and they were all intimidating creations. And yet none of those towering creatures were quite as scary as Gollum. A hobbit mutated into a monster by exposure to the One Ring, played with Troubled Inhumanity and Insidious Menace by Andy Serkis. And, of course, a team of talented CG animators. Yeah, Gollum is, I mean, you know, what can you say about that character?
Yeah.
And how beautifully brought to life it is.
When I first came back to the States after living abroad, you know, I think I went to go see it with a friend. Now, I had already seen Two Towers when I was abroad. But it was his first time seeing it, and we had to leave in the middle of the movie because he was so terrified.
Of Gollum? Gollum?
Yeah. He was freaking, he was having like a panic attack. I mean, even as a kid, I felt bad. I was a little annoyed. I was like, oh, I really like this movie. I want to see it again. But, yeah, no, he was having a literal panic attack because he was so terrified of this boogeyman, essentially. Yeah.
It's a great character, and you know, brought to life by an incredible team and a fantastic performance by Andy Serkis.
Where is his Oscar?
He's never going to get one. They're never going to give a stop motion Oscar.
But he's acting.
I know he's acting.
He's doing this.
I know.
It's very.
I mean, all three of the eight movies are unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, the Caesar character. I mean. Forget it. It's amazing. So, I mean, maybe it'll happen, but I don't think the Academy is going to think that. I don't think they're going to understand. A lot of people in the Academy just aren't going to understand what kind of effort and what kind of acting and what kind of performance you have to put into it.
Yeah. How much research.
Yeah. But, yeah. That was groundbreaking as hell, too. The Lord of the Rings, I mean. Yeah.
And it holds up surprisingly well for being, you know, getting into the 20 years.
Yeah. I love those movies. I love those movies. I think Return of the King is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. They're all great.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all great. Mortal Engines. What?
Another Peter Jackson. Well, not, I don't know if he directed it, but he produced it.
Audiences slept on Christian Rivers' Mortal Engines, and it's their loss. Christian Rivers' sci-fi epic may have had a formulaic plot, but it was rife with visual wonders, including thrilling car chases where entire cities were the cars, chase scenes through metropolises and getting demolished by giant buzzsaws, and of course, Shrike, one of the most unsettling movie villains in recent memory, a cybernetic corpse. Shrike pursues the movie's hero to prove his love for her by turning her into an undead monster just like himself. Shrike is played by Stephen Lang and a team of animators who infuse the character with disturbingly unnatural movements and a grim, frightening glare. What does he look like?
It's not unlike... but you haven't seen Game of Thrones. That's the closest analogy I have for that character. It's like he looks a little bit like one of the White Walkers. It is a very good CGI.
I know what a White Walker looks like.
Oh yeah, it looks a little bit like that.
Okay,
that kind of like not quite blue skin. He's very unique. He does look like a cybernetic corpse.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Do you see what I mean though?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at him right now. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
The movie wasn't fantastic.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, it's fine.
That's pretty cool though. That's a pretty cool looking character. And Weta created it too. So there you go. Because it was, you know, a Peter Jackson production. So of course his company is going to get in there and do the effects, and the effects are probably really good. I just didn't see the movie. I missed the whole thing. So all right, let's take a break for some weather. And we'll come back and we'll talk more about the scariest CGI monsters in movies. And then after the 4:30 news, we're going to need two people to call in and be the first contestant. And the second contestant will play separate rounds, and we are going to play some Know Your Onion. So get ready to call in after the 4:30 news and get some Know Your Onion. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here As we are every weekday morning, I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Wednesday, Wildcard Wednesday. Yeah, man, Wildcard Wednesday. All right. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from Glenn.
Okay.
From the soundtrack of an Adam Sandler movie called Little Nicky.
God. I had successfully forgotten about that movie until now. All right. Welcome back, everybody. So we've been talking about the scariest CGI monsters in movies as part of the horror theme that we've been doing in honor of our wonderful visit with Rich Coe's Sven Gulli and how much fun it's going to be this weekend at the Flashback Weekend Horror Convention. So, talking about some of the other scary CGI creations, let's brings us to the article where they are talking about The Mist. Frank Darabont's adaptation of Stephen King's harrowing story only made The Mist more frightening. A group of people get trapped in a grocery store as a mysterious mist fills their small town, and inside there are all kinds of unbelievable monsters, ranging from killer insects to Lovecraftian behemoths that stagger the imagination. It's their world now. We only live in it while we can. Yeah, I love that movie. I really do. And I know he wanted to shoot it in black and white, so you can see it in black and white. There's a version of it that's available in black and white, and I highly recommend it. But I'll never forget the first screening of this movie, of The Mist. I sat in a screening room full of critics. And then that ending happened, and we were all like, what? Like, could not believe that the movie ended like that. Like, stunned.
It was a bold move.
And it's not the ending that Stephen King wrote. Darabont wrote that. And Stephen King's like, yeah, that's the way I like it now to end. But I couldn't believe they went there. I was like, mm-hmm. Are you kidding me? You're going to end this movie like this? This is how we're walking out of the theater?
There were multiple moments throughout that movie that I was shocked that they were willing to do it.
No, there's a lot. I mean, I think it's a terrific movie.
Yeah.
And you know what's really amazing about it? You know, all the creatures are cool.
Yeah, very cool.
And there's some, you know, there's quality kills in it and mm-hmm. all that cool stuff. But the stuff that's going on in the grocery store with the characters... Marcia Gay Harden is unbelievable. Marcia Gay Harden is unbelievable.
She's going for it.
Yeah. And all of that stuff is just as interesting and compelling as any of the crazy creatures and the special effects that are in The Mist outside or in the stock room in the back whenever you know they get in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got Todd from Boogie Nights. So, you know, right there. That's a winner.
You know, I'm going to make it my mission to find out if Thomas Jane's doing any press for anything.
I love Thomas Jane.
And just get him in here so that you can refer to him as Todd from Boogie Nights.
He's Todd from Boogie Nights. He's always going to be Todd from Boogie Nights. Todd Parker. I love him in that movie. So, yeah, it's weird. He's my favorite character in Boogie Nights is Todd.
He's a great character.
Todd's my favorite character in a movie full of unbelievably great characters.
That's true.
But for some reason, I don't know what, from the very first time I saw the movie, I was like, this Todd guy is awesome.
I really... What's the name? Do you remember the name of Don Cheadle's character?
No.
Because he's so good in it.
Because for a while, because he was called Cowboy for a while, because that was his look. Remember he kept changing his look? He's at the party, he's got the dreadlocks. He's got the dreadlocks.
Well, I just... Him in the stereo...
He's trying to sell the stereo?
Yeah, Buck Swope.
Buck. That's Buck.
And he's just like, yeah, talking about the, you know, the TC9 or something like that.
Yeah.
Goes and pops in like an 8-track and it's country music. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, you can real feel the ass
yeah.
on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the scene in the donut shop, man.
What? Out of nowhere.
Oh.
Great, but out of nowhere.
Yeah. His reaction is great, too. So, Melora Walters, too, in the car. Claudia. Who would go on to become Claudia. All right, moving on. A Quiet Place. Yeah, those creatures were pretty cool. They were pretty scary, man. The acclaimed monster movie A Quiet Place features novel beasts that attack and brutally slay anyone who makes any kind of sound, forcing our heroes to live in absolute silence for fear of instant death. It's such a scary concept that director John Krasinski probably could have gotten away with not showing them at all, but when they do appear, they are unusually freaky creatures with segmented heads and razor-sharp teeth. They absolutely live up to the movie's hype. Yeah, their creatures are awesome. And, yeah, and it's a scary movie.
Very much so.
The Ritual.
Ooh, yeah.
We don't want to go into too much detail about this one since it's a relatively recent film and the monster isn't in a lot of it, but David Bruckner's excellent horror film, The Ritual, about a group of hikers who get trapped in a woods, with a cult, features a grotesque image of a monster that comes back into play later on in the most unexpected and surprising reveal that's hard to describe, that's way more creepier to discover on your own. It's one of the most disturbing CG monsters of its kind.
Have you seen The Ritual?
I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't crazy about the movie.
I really liked it.
Did you?
I would say it was, Well, I just like that it's in that same vein as like something like The Wicker Man or Midsummer or
right.
Apostle with Dan Stevens.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that kind of folk cult, you know, horror setting. I think that's really cool.
Next one they mentioned, Shin Godzilla, for God's sake. Longest tail of any Godzilla in Godzilla movie history.
Huge tail.
Oh my God. You could take out 80 buildings with one swipe. The classic version of Godzilla walking around and punching monsters like an old-fashioned bouncer is so familiar now that he's more beloved than scary. But the impressively smart reboot, Shin Godzilla, made him horrifying again. Godzilla emerges from the water, half-formed, giant fish-eyed, writhing monstrosity that doesn't move like any Godzilla you've ever seen before, and as it rapidly evolves into something a little more familiar, with a shocking introduction sticks in your head, making him more unnatural than ever before.
Best atomic breath, if you ask me, too.
Yeah. It's one of the best Godzilla movies. I mean, I saw it at the Music Box and when it opened, and I just was I lost my mind. But it's a great one. It's a classic. It's a great one. And then finally, Starship Troopers.
Yeah. Yes. I'm doing my part.
One of my favorite moments in that movie is at the end when Doogie Howser is dressed up like a Nazi, and he puts his hand on the bug, and there's a pause, and he goes, "It's afraid," which is like that's my favorite movie. I love that movie, man. I love it. And I know that on the set, Paul Verhoeven was telling the cast that they were doing a great job. That they were, "Oh, this is the best acting I've ever seen. Such great acting."
Just taking them for a ride.
Ridiculous.
Well, that's why it's so genius. Paul Verhoeven literally had Nazis in his backyard, and this was him dealing with the ridiculousness of fascism.
It is ridiculous. I love that movie though, and I loved it. Like, hey, let's all party. Michael Ironside's going to bust out some beer and fiddles, like bust out the electric fiddle because we're going to party. Here's what they say. Paul Verhoeven's epic sci-fi blockbuster satire, which uses fascist propaganda storytelling tropes to subvert our whole understanding of the action genre, features some of the most monstrous creatures imaginable. Giant killer bugs. The film's outlandish violence makes these alien insects seem huge and dangerous, so much so that you have to look closely at the film's subtext to realize that they're not the oppressors. They're the noble resistance fighters who are being dehumanized by filmmakers with an agenda. They're scary, not only because we're buying into the film's disturbing meta-narrative, impeccable VFX in one of the most daring big-budget films in history. So, there you go. I saw that movie like 10 times at the Bruin View. Perfect movie for the Bruin View. Perfect. All right. Listen, we're going to break for the news, but we want to get you guys in here now. We need two people to get through. The first two people get through will be our contestant number one and our contestant number two. Here's what you do. Call right now. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And you'll get to play a round of Know Your Onion. This is Tom as your host, and he will read news headlines. And you have to decide whether they are real or whether they're from the satirical, fake, funny news paper, The Onion. So, Know Your Onion, first two people through, they will be our contestants for this morning. 312-981-7200 for Know Your Onion. News after this. All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Wednesday morning, Wildcard Wednesday. You hear me, Wildcard Wednesday? So there you go. Who requested the Bee Gees?
It's coming to us from the 414.
414 area code. Wanted to hear a little Staying Alive, featured in the movie Airplane. All right. Welcome back, everybody. So we've got this game that we play that Tom came up with. It is called Know Your Onion. And the idea is this. Tom is your host. He will read you a series of news headlines, and you have to guess whether they are real or from the fake satirical funny newspaper, The Onion. So your answer is you hear the news headline, and your answer is either it's real or it's The Onion. And here is the Know Your Onion begins now. We already have our two contestants. They're all ready to go. You guys, hang on the line, and we'll get to them in a second. And why don't we do the intro and get the crowd in here?
It's time to Know Your Onion.
Yeah. 60,000 people always cram in here every Wednesday morning after the 4:30 news.
It's literally unbelievable.
It's crazy. All right, so that's the idea. Let's get our first contestant on, and it's Chris on WGN. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. All right, you familiar with The Onion?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so the idea is Tom will read you a news headline, and you have to decide whether it is a real news headline or an Onion news headline, okay? All right, let's hear it. Let's get to it.
All right, Chris, here is your first headline. A well-deserved break. After all his hard work, Robert Mueller is relaxing by writing a report about himself. Is that real or is that The Onion?
I think I'm going to have to say Onion.
Let's see. Very nice, Chris.
Yes. The only way he can relax is if he's writing a report at this point. So. All right, you got your one for one, Chris. That's a good start, my friend.
All right,
let's move on. Here's a story in Arizona. An Arizona man learns mom's body sold to military and detonated in experiment. Is that real or is that The Onion?
Arizona, you say? Maybe they sent it to that Area 51 out there somewhere. I'll say it's true.
Let's see.
Woo-hoo!
Very nice.
Yeah. Real headline. Two for two. You only need one more because you got to get a majority. So you need three out of five. All right.
All right.
Let's go over here. John Delaney, presidential candidate, befuddled by question asking him to imagine himself as a president. Is that real or is that The Onion?
I'll say it's The Onion.
Oh, I like that.
Wow, three for three.
Wow, nice job, Chris. Nice job. I swear I thought that last one was real. I swear to you I thought that last one was real.
What, that he was befuddled?
He was befuddled and torn apart by Elizabeth Warren last night.
That he was.
All right. So, Chris, congratulations. You were three for three. That's the best way you can go. And you got yourself Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations, or you can order online at loumalnati's.com. Congratulations, Chris.
All right, thank you.
All right, man, hang on. You got to hang on now, Chris. Have some patience. Hang on. We got to get some details and some information from you off the air. And there you go. Yeah, I honestly was surprised to hear that was an onion. I thought it was real.
The one that got me was Arizona man learns mom's body sold to the military and detonated.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Real thing.
Yeah, real. Oh, man. All right. Okay. All right. Well, nice job by our first contestant, Chris. Went three for three, got himself some Lou Malnati's, and now we've got our second contestant. to bring on, and that is Lee on WGN. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. Okay. How are you?
All right. You know The Onion?
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Okay, so all you have to do is Tom's going to read you a news headline. You have to say whether it's real or it's The Onion, because everything is weird nowadays. So, Tom, you ready?
All right, we're ready to go. Lee, here is your first headline. 1 in 4 food delivery drivers admit to eating your food. Is that real or is that The Onion?
Real.
Let's see. That's very good, Lee. That is real, coming to us from NPR.
Yeah. Yeah, that's real.
That's upsetting is what it is.
Well, yeah, it is.
It's quite upsetting. My White Castle?
Yeah, it's quite upsetting. Not surprising, I got to say, but
yes.
But upsetting. Okay. Okay, Lee, nice job. You're 1 for 1. All right. Here we go again.
All right, Lee, your second headline. More presidential candidates are taking a strident pro-caviar stance to appeal to the Democratic Socialite wing of the party. Is that real or is that The Onion?
I think that's The Onion.
Let's see.
Shall we?
Very good, Lee. That is The Onion.
Pro-caviar stance.
Personally, I think this. We should all be pro-caviar.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, again, you're 2 for 2, Lee. Let's see if we can do a clean swipe for both of our contestants this morning. 3 for 3. See if you can get it, because you win if you get this one right, Lee.
Okay, Lee, your next headline. Will Hitler headquarters makeover create a Nazi theme park? Is that real or is that The Onion?
Oh, dear. I wish it was Onion, but I think it's real.
Let's find out.
That's a real headline?
A very real headline. The Wolf's Lair in Poland may be getting a makeover. And that was the bunker that was famously depicted in Valkyrie, where they tried to kill Hitler with an explosive.
Wow. Well, there you go. Boy, we had some smart contestants this morning. Man, oh man. 3 for 3 from Chris and 3 for 3 from Lee. Lee, you win. That's how you play it. That's how you play the game. You got yourself a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. You can find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations. You can order online at loumalnati's.com. Congratulations, Lee, and hang on, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, there you go. That's how you play the game. It's that easy. And even if you don't get the majority of the news headlines correct, everybody's a winner. So there you go. And we'll do it again next week. That is Know Your Onion. So study up on your onion and study up on your real news. And we'll do it again next week. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you would like to jump in here. 312-981-7200. All right, we're going to close out the show here. Our final topic is going to be 4 weird pop culture lawsuits that are straight out of movies. Crack.com put this together. These are really weird pop culture lawsuits. They say, we like to think that our various forms of artistic escape aren't created by faceless corporate machines for the purpose of simply making money, but sometimes that's the unfortunate reality. And in pursuit of giant sacks filled with green bills, pop culture ends up also seeing its fair share of giant lawsuits filled with brown turds. For example, here they are. These are real. Marvel denied its own canon for a tax break. The X-Men are humans. There's no debate about this. They're not aliens, monsters. They're humans with special genetic traits, like the cherry coke of people. Only an absolutely clueless geek poser would argue like otherwise, like Marvel. In 1993, international trade lawyer Sherry Singer and Indy Singh, both employed by Marvel, discovered a bizarre mutation in how federal import tax tariffs are applied. If a company wants to import quote-unquote dolls that represent humans, they have to pay a tax of 12%. If that company imports toys, quote-unquote, that represent non-humans, however, they only have to pay a tax of 6.8%. For an entity like Marvel, which licenses scads of action figures, that works out to a massive potential savings. Thus, they petitioned the government to reclassify all of their imported wares as non-human toys. The ensuing legal battle went on for over a half a decade and saw Marvel and the U.S. government go through each character in the company's canon, from Spider-Man to the Fantastic Four to, yes, the X-Men, and write legal briefs about their humanity or that or lack thereof. The figure of Kingpin resembles a man with a suit carrying a staff. Nothing in the storyline indicates that Kingpin possesses superhuman powers, yet Kingpin is known to have exceedingly great strength, and the figure itself has a large, stout body with a disproportionately small head and disproportionately large hands. Even though dolls can be caricatures of human beings, the court is of the opinion that the freakishness of this figure's appearance, coupled with the fabled Spider-Man storyline, of which it belongs, but does not warrant a finding that the figure is a human being. Took until 2003 for a judge to declare Marvel the winner. It wasn't a decision she made lightly. When describing how she reached her ruling, she explained that she based her verdict not just on the masses of legal papers, but on sides had provided a litany of action figures, as well as examinations under clothing and said figures. It was a Pyrrhic victory for Marvel, though, when news reached that the X-Men had been stripped of their humanity for tax reasons. They responded with as much understanding and empathy as you'd expect from scorned nerds. As the editor of one popular fan site beautifully articulated, this decision is unthinkable. Marvel's superheroes are supposed to be human as you and I. They live in New York, they have families, they go to work, and now they're no longer human? Marvel wound up getting so much heat, in fact, that they were soon forced to issue a statement saying that, of course, everyone's favorite superheroes are still human. An about face that was visible from Asteroid M. So for tax purposes, Marvel's like, no. They're not human.
They're not people.
We don't want to have to pay taxes on these guys. So these are all real, and they're weird pop culture lawsuits. Got a couple of more to get through. If you want to jump in for anything, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Right. Wildcard Wednesday. Yeah! Concludes, and my dad requested that, didn't he?
Yeah, very special request from the elder DeGilio.
Yeah, my dad requested a little Prince for this Wednesday morning on Wildcard Wednesday. My dad's got good taste in music, so there it is. That wraps up Wildcard Wednesday. Coming up, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, we are talking about some real weird pop culture lawsuits. Let's see. How about this? Netflix and Sabrina were dragged to hell by the Satanic Temple. When the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina first hit Netflix last year, it was praised for its writing, characterization, and design, despite being the obvious target market for the show. However, the Satanic Temple wasn't on board. Instead, they filed a $150 million lawsuit against Netflix and Warner Brothers for stealing their copyrighted design of the Baphomet. That might seem like a high price tag for what is ultimately amounts to someone on the production staff copying an even evil garden gnome, but the temple justified the amount by pointing out that the show used the statue in association with the bad guys, and therefore implicitly made an association between evil magical skullduggery of Sabrina and the real organization that uses his statue as its mascot. The lawsuit was eventually settled, and although the terms are confidential, it's a fair bet the temple got a sizable 666 figure sum.
All right.
Again, these are real, everybody. How about this one? Iron Maiden doesn't understand parody.
I could see that.
Living the dream of cranky 60-year-olds everywhere, the metal band Iron Maiden recently filed a $2 million suit against a video game developer. The band, currently most famous for Hot Topic t-shirts. What do you mean that's what they're most famous for?
They're just being mean.
Allegedly that the title of an upcoming game was an incredibly blatant infringement on their intellectual property. The title in question, Iron Maiden. I-O-N. Iron Maiden. A retro-style game about a bomb disposal expert tasked with stopping the machinations of an evil transhumanist cult leader and his army of cybernetically enhanced soldiers. Iron Maiden are also arguing that Iron Maiden is similar to Legacy of the Beast, a game that Maiden released in 2016. As further proof that this serious problem is a serious problem for the band, they provided a list of instances where fans have mistaken Iron Maiden for the official band tie-in. They clicked onto Iron Maiden forum thread thinking that it was a thread to Iron Maiden. They read an article about Iron Maiden video game, waiting for it to be explained to the connection of Iron Maiden. They expressed genuine excitement over an Iron Maiden video game. And they said all that's missing is an Iron Maiden soundtrack, and the Iron Maiden song Can I Play With Madness would fit right in. Written a lot and boldly dumb legal strategies over the years, but we've had to hand it to Maiden on this one, claiming that a pun is causing irreparable damage to your brand. That's bold. Claiming that your case has merit because your fans can't read. That's a galaxy brain level maneuver that they'll be teaching for years at shady lawyer schools, seeing as how it worked. The band, the developer caved and renamed it Iron Fury. While the band presumably celebrated with Metamucil at their early bird dinner. So they're just going after them age-wise? That's what they're really doing?
Hey, I think they got to give Bruce Dickinson a little bit more respect.
Yeah, all right. Okay, and here's the last one. A court ruled that The Shape of Water has too much bestiality to have been stolen. Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water so successfully made us question notions of love, communication, and every school trip to the aquarium that it won the Academy Award for Best Picture. With this acclaim, however, came two accusations that del Toro had plagiarized the screenplay. The first wound up being dropped after accusers chatted with the man and came away convinced that he didn't have the foggiest clue who they were. The second accusation, which concerned a play titled Let Me Hear You Whisper, wasn't quite going away so easily, especially considering how the play's plot shares lots of similarities with The Shape of Water, namely it being about an introverted woman who falls in love with a sea creature, in this case a dolphin, who is the subject of some bizarre government experiments. Del Toro denied he'd ripped off Let Me Hear You Whisper, and the case went to trial, where it was dismissed almost immediately on the grounds that A, woman falling in love with a non-human creature is an entire genre of fiction, and more importantly, B, the lead character in Let Me Hear You Whisper doesn't have sex with the dolphin. Now, if you'll excuse us, we're going to throw our sexy Flipper remake script into the trash before we get sued. it was not stolen because it had too much bestiality in it.
Who would have thought?
Oh, man.
Who would have thought?
So those are real. That's what people are paying lawyers and judges and stuff for. I remember there was a lot of controversy about a short film that came out like before Shape of Water, and the poster art even looked like it?
Yeah.
I remember they did like a sort of a scene-by-scene comparison mm-hmm. to it, and it was pretty shockingly close to what Del Toro did. Now, I'm not accusing Del Toro of ripping anybody off, but it was a little strange to see just how unbelievably close these two films were in the look and in what the plot was. And it wasn't a dolphin. This was a Gilman. It was Gilman, the producer of Kelly and Ryan.
So. Now is oh my gosh, it was they just I just had the title of it here. Yeah, the short film was called, it was a short 2015 Dutch film called The Space Between Us.
Yeah.
So
it is, if you go back and look at it, a lot of really strong similarities, but so. Okay. Well, listen, everybody, we're going to head out of here. The news is coming up next. Tomorrow on Thursday's show, Steve Procopi is going to be here. He, reviews movies on the Monday morning movie reviews with us, me and Eric. And he is one of the hosts along with myself at the Flashback Convention. He's going to come down live in studio. We're going to reminisce about all the fun flashbacks from the past and talk about the flashback that's happening this weekend. And it'll be Triple Play Thursday as well. And remember, I'm off on Friday and I'm off on Monday because it's going to be a crazy weekend up at Flashback Convention. So Steve will be with us tomorrow.